This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
I'd like to, before I go any further, acknowledge, as Craddock started, acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples that are here. Unfortunately, we couldn't get an elder here today. I think they're all getting worked up for NAIDOC week. But they have passed on their best wishes and welcome to Canberra. Today's forum is about, as you know, is urban an appropriate term of reference to Indigenous people living in urban environments? How is the culture and identity expressed by Indigenous people living in urban environs? And in what ways are Indigenous cultures represented in museums and keeping places? Now, one might say, you know, what's in a name? You know, what's in a name? But I think obviously lots, because this area and this use of the word urban has generated a lot of discussion, because obviously it's much more than the name. It carries a whole lot of history. You know, in the 80s it was associated with activism, and then in the 90s there was a bit of identity politics thrown in, and there was then a sense that it meant lesser. And then, you know, we know all those kinds of things. Well, you know, and then there's others who will say, well, you know, hang on, that's where we're at. We have our own culture. We've developed differently than different parts of Australia. You know, it's a reality. That's who I am. Others will repel it with great dismissiveness. So some claim, some celebrate it, some dispel it, and some couldn't get a staff. So, you know, obviously everybody's using the word differently for different reasons. And, of course, there's a situation of, you know, like suits of clothes. You wear different clothes for different situations. It doesn't mean you can choose not to be defined, of course, and slip across a whole lot of different areas for different reasons. But anyway, I'm sure you guys have got lots more to say about it. But that is why, in fact, I did that exhibition, 70% Urban, and whilst it's not the most fabulous exhibition in the universe, because I didn't borrow, we didn't want to borrow anything. I want to make a point that the museums, as Craddock intimated, museums are an outcome of collecting practices of the past. Unlike galleries, museums do have the deposits from anthropologists and ethnographers and so on, which we are grateful for, but, of course, it's basically northern biased. This museum's only been open since 2001, And I'm very mindful of the fact that it doesn't represent, you know, the more contemporary cultures. So one of the ways to make this focus, and fortunate in the right climate, the right man and so on, was to just look at what we did have in our collections that you could describe as urban. And for the purpose of this exhibition, I've sort of said urbanisation started from the moment of colonisation. I'm not saying it's just the last 30 years. It started when people started settling. And therefore, we could draw on stuff going right back to sketchbooks and barrack and wearers, boab nuts and so on. So when you go down, you'll see that. But we've actually just drawn on, for the exception of one or two pieces, Gordon's Judgment by His Peers and I think one other. With the exception of two pieces, it's all just what's in our collection. So you can see it's you know, very interesting, very eclectic, very diverse, but very small. There are some other bits, but what that's enabled me to do, or us to do, is to draw attention to the fact we need to collect more in this area. And we have already started on that. So it was just to make a good point on that, and also to make the point that we are very interested, and I'm particularly very interested in the urban culture and all the kind of cultural product that comes out of it, whether you call it art or whatever you choose to call it. Michael Aird is the first chair of this panel, and the panel is the Dream of a Community Museum. Michael's born in Southport, spent most of his life living in that region, the traditional country of his ancestors. In 1990, he graduated with a Bachelor of Arts in Anthropology from the University of Queensland. His main interest is, as most of us here will know, is urban Aboriginal photographic history. He's worked in the area of Aboriginal culture heritage for over 20 years, and in that time he's curated many exhibitions as well as publishing books and articles. For 5 years, he was the curator of Aboriginal Studies at the Queensland Museum, which is where we sort of first met and had common interests and bridged the gulf between museums and galleries, which is one of my highest priorities, and is currently the director of the Aboriginal-owned publishing house, Kiora Press. So welcome, Michael, who'll introduce the others.
I'll start by acknowledging the traditional owners, and I think in anywhere, traditional owners play such an important role. As Richard and I were talking last night, in any community you go to, it's traditional owners that have been there for a long time, that are established, and often when people are travelling, it's the traditional families that look after the new people to an area and worry about them, and the same here. Wish I could say the same about some of the government people that we have to deal with in my country, on the Gold Coast, where development's more important than anything else, but we still get the tokenistic words that they acknowledge and respect us, but dealing with them is not the same. And I'd like to, particularly thank Barbara and Margot for inviting me down, and as Margot said, I worked in the Aboriginal Cultural Heritage area for over 20 years, and I think being invited to conferences like this for the networking, the just professional development, it is really important. It makes, being in the game for that long, you sort of struggle doing what you do, scratching to earn a living, and it's times like this that you actually sort of think it's all worthwhile. So it's really good, and it's good to be here with such a very strong, confident panel with all plenty to say. And I think one thing you'll be hearing a lot today is, when discussing urban Aboriginal culture, just the stories that urban Aboriginal people have had to live through. And there's a lot of stories where people have had to do it pretty tough in the past, and even now I think there's still some things that aren't that, still a lot of things that aren't that good now, and people doing it pretty tough and putting up with all types of government policies and different things. And I'll just start by telling one little story that a friend of mine, a non-Aboriginal guy who grew up in Sydney, told me this story, and it's just for a guy that's not Aboriginal, doesn't really had much to do with Aboriginal people, he told a story that I think brought in so many little elements of what urban Aboriginal people have had to live through. The story was about his actually father-in-law. So his wife was growing up in Sydney in the 50s or 60s, and next to his wife, non-Aboriginal family, next to his wife lived an Aboriginal couple. They had a few sons. And this guy, he was apparently the first qualified Aboriginal truck driver, semi-trailer, he was the first Aboriginal guy in New South Wales to have a semi-trailer licence. And he was really proud of that. And that in itself, look back to all my old people and what they achieved, how hard they had to work, how they had to prove to the government that we're as good as everybody else, we can achieve things like that. And becoming a doctor or a lawyer back then wasn't much of an option for Aboriginal people, but becoming a truck driver I know my grandfather owned a truck and he contracted that out. And that's something that, people were proud of. Then these boys that they had, they weren't allowed to go to the shop to buy a loaf of bread unless they pulled their socks up and buttoned up every button on their shirt and dressed perfectly. And that reminds me of my childhood. I remember my mother being ashamed of being Aboriginal, growing up in an urban environment, she made sure that us boys, three boys and then later on a younger sister in my family, we had to be better dressed than everybody, because my mother was just so conscious of, didn't want anybody to think that we might be poor or less than everybody else. If I ever ripped a pair of pants, I'd say, Mum, can you fix up my pants? And she'd say, no, I'll buy you a new pair. So my father had to work pretty hard so that we had those things. But that's what it was. They had to work hard just to survive. And then the story with this guy, my friend's father-in-law, he thought the world of this Aboriginal guy. And a big international, black international act came to Sydney. I think it was either Shirley Bassey or Sammy Davis Jr. And they're playing at one of the big RSL clubs or football clubs at the time, and this guy thought the world of his neighbour, so I'm going to shout him and his wife a ticket to see this concert. And they walk in the door, real big night, real looking forward to a good night, and the whole room went quiet. How dare these two Aboriginal people come to our night out? And they sit down, I got over that, they sit down, and they just couldn't get a serve. They couldn't get served, sitting at the table waiting for someone to serve them. And this guy just really wanted his mate to have a good night out. Instead of causing a fuss and ruining the night, he says, I'm just going to the toilet, I'll be back in a minute. And he went and searched for the waiter that he thought wasn't coming to their table. And he just leans in his ear and says, I don't get a jug of beer on my table, in the next 2 minutes I'm going to fucking punch your head in. And back they went and tried to enjoy their night. And it's not a horrible story compared to others of horrible racism or anything, but it's just an example at every level. Even when people are doing their best, doing everything they can to survive, to fit in the urban culture, they still come up across these little things that just make their life different to everybody else's. So that's it for me. So first I'll introduce Richard Bell. I've been given some bios, but there's just a question mark for Richard Bell. just says bio, question mark. So I really don't think Richard needs an intro. He's someone that I've been working with for about 15 years now. He's always been entertaining. He's always got plenty to say. And he's a bit quieter by himself, but when there's people around, he always puts on a good performance. So looking forward to that.
I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal as well. And I'd like to thank Margo for inviting me down here and insisting that I turn up. But, look, there's been so much said about this urban thing, but nothing has been articulated by ourselves. And I'm hoping that after the end of this, that there will be a lot of the issues that... You right there? Yeah. Like, I'm hoping that a lot of the issues are looked at. You know, like, we're in the early part of the 21st century, and we have a lot of things in front of us as Aboriginal people. You know, like, how do we move forward into the 21st century and maintain our Aboriginality? You know, like, what is the Aboriginality? What is non-negotiable? What is negotiable from the old times? I think we need to be looking at some of those things. And I hope that we get into the nitty-gritty with the other people here, because I'm sure they've all prepared for this. Whereas I tend to do what a lot of people do, which is just fly by the seat of my pants. But I think it was a big mistake to put me on first. You know, like, it just is, you know, because if there was a big crowd here, you know, like, there'd be a threat of some of them leaving, you know, because I tend to get, you know, quite creative with the King's or the Queen's English at times. So that seems to get people a little bit dodgy as well. You know, like, looking at my experience growing up as an urban black fella, well, I got to admit I'm a recovering racist. You know, like, I used to hate white people, all white people. I used to hate yous. I haven't forgiven yous, I just don't hate you anymore. I'm also, because of the nature of my upbringing, I'm a recovering homophobe. Well, that's how all males were brought up in Australia in the 50s and 60s when I did my schooling and that sort of thing. And that obviously continued into the 70s and the 80s, and I hold up as proof of that the behaviour of the Canterbury Rugby League football team and various AFL footballers and soccer players. There's this football culture, which is very demeaning to both homosexual people and to women. So I'm on the path to recovery to all those things. And, well, being, you know, kind of opinionated, I get to... And I get a forum too, you know, to say lots of different things. I've heard that there was going to be a big mob of people come here, but they heard that there was some radicals coming here. You know, like, and Vernon Arkey said that I was the only radical here. Well, yes, I am a radical. I'm from the radical centre. So I'm well to the left of John Howard and Kevin Rudd. You know, like, I don't know. I think there's a contest at the moment to see who can go further to the right. I think John Howard threw down a big challenge to Kevin Rudd recently when he sent in the troops into Aboriginal communities. And when we're talking about you know, child abuse and that sort of thing, you know, I think there's a lot of the white people got some abuse here. You know, like, I saw on the plane coming down, I saw this kid and crying, you know, and a parent wouldn't give that little kid what they wanted. You know, I think, damn, that's child abuse, you know. And I come, I walk out down to have breakfast this morning, and there's these little goldfish, you know, from, and they was, it was freezing cold, you know, I can imagine, damn, you know, those goldfish, they're supposed to be up in Brisbane, you know. And, you know, back where I come from, you know, like, I think there's animal abuse here and things. They should send the troops in. I can tell them to go, where to go too. It's over in the pool, the little pond there at the ANU. Anyway, getting back to urban, the urban experience, you know, like, I was born in Charleville a long time ago, not quite 40,000 years, but quite a while ago now. Back in those days, you know, like, I was living in the Yumba, which is us blackfellas out in southwestern Queensland call an Aboriginal camp. And it was on the sandhill across from the hospital. At that stage, you know, like, there wasn't enough tin shacks, so I spent the first 2 years of my life living in a tent. But we was lucky there in Charleville because we had running water. We had one tap. When the Americans built the hospital across the railway tracks from us, somebody, one of the American soldiers sent a tap over, you know, one line over there. So we had one tap, you know, something like 24 families. We shared one tap. We were quite happy with that, you know, because you know, it meant that we didn't have to carry the water 2 kilometres up from the river. And then I lived in lots of other little country towns, always on the outskirts of town. You know, like, we weren't allowed to live in the towns. We weren't allowed to shop in the towns. You know, like, the Chinese didn't have any problem there. You know, they thought our money was just as good as the white people, so we could buy fruit and veg from them. And there was the Greeks, you know, when they started to move into the towns and that, the Greeks and Italians and the Lebanese, they didn't give a fuck, you know, they just took our money, you know. So, you know, that helped to break down a barrier there. And there's lots of things that happened in that period, you know, which have formed the basis of my work. So I'm using the stories from my life experience and trying to make sense of this world, this particular part of the world where, look, I don't hate all you white people. You know, I just don't like you, that's all. Because, you know, you're really thoughtless and it's your fault that, you know, that we are treated so badly. That we don't have treaties. You know, like, I was shocked to find out, you know, that we can't even participate in carbon trading on Aboriginal lands because we don't own the trees. You know, you think, oh, okay, well, maybe not everybody owns trees. Well, yes, you do. You own the trees in your backyard. We don't. You know, we were barred from owning land for many, many years. You know, like, and it's only been recently in Queensland that the legislation was changed to enable Aboriginal people to be able to own land. Now, the most common and most popular method of wealth creation in this country is actually housing and real estate. So when you consider that Aboriginal people haven't been able to own land, well, then we haven't... There's been so much disadvantage just built into our circumstances. So for us to catch up even to, you know, is going to take generations, you know, perhaps 100 years to catch up to the rest of society, if we so choose. You know, like, I myself don't have any inclination to buy a home for myself. You know, besides the fact that, you know, I've got 6 kids and they'd all be fighting over it, that's not the thing. I've always aspired to live in a house, to get given a house by a black housing company, you know, that I could call my own, that I could, you know, give to any one of my kids, that sort of thing. So, but I wouldn't mind buying a warehouse, you know, just, you know, so I could have an artist studio. But there was some... One of my friend's brothers, he made a comment in the press about private ownership of on Aboriginal reserves. I think, damn, you're like who's going to buy your house? You know, like in Doomadgee. You know, who's going to buy your house? You know, like in one of these reserves. You know, like it's just absurd. You know, like to consider it. You know, like and you know, what are the traditional owners going to say? You know, like you've excised a piece of their land. You know, like that's creating mischief, I think. You know, I think John Howard's very clever. He's creating a mischief, you know, dividing our people. You know, it's easy to control Aboriginal people because, you know, like you just cause a row. You know, I worked with the government for a little while back in the 70s, and I worked with Aboriginal community organisations as well, you know. And I don't know how many times I've seen white fellas come to an Aboriginal community, you know, look around there. Oh, this is terrible because it looks like a war zone. You know, like the houses, you know, like are really untidy. There's smashed windows, you know, smashed up walls, cars in the yard, all this sort of shit, you know. And, you know, they say, oh, this is horrible. You know, how many people live in that house? Oh, 22. How many in that house? 25. Oh, how many in that one? 28. You know, how many in this one here? Oh, only 15 there. Two-bedroom houses, you know, one or two, three-bedroom houses on the missions and reserves, you know. And they say, oh, this is horrible. We're going to have to get you all new houses, you know. And, of course, you know, the blackfellas get all excited. Oh, we're going to get a new house. Then that white fella go back down to the DAA office or the ADC office or whatever it is, and he's talking about, you know, like talking about these blackfellas need these houses, eh? Then they get the message, you know, you actually can't give them all new houses. You know, you can give them four. You know, so they need 30 or 40 new houses on the reserve, and they give them four. You know what's going to happen? Who know what's going to happen next? Yeah. And what happens? Them houses, they get burnt down, eh? Yeah. Or there's some places there bullets flying, you know, past people. Yeah. And you know, this is the sort of tactics that are being used. You know, like the largest community, Aboriginal community in the Northern Territory, has a population of about 2,800 people. Maybe sometimes it'd be over 3,000 people. They have 700 primary school students, no high school. If the children in that town want to go to high school, they have to go to Tennant Creek, Alice Springs, or Darwin. Right? I lived in Charleville, you know, like population pretty similar. We had two primary schools and a high school that went all the way to year 12. They don't have a copper in that place there. Can you imagine a town of 2,800 people or 3,000 people with no copper, no coppers? There's a mine 30 kilometres down the road with 130 white guys. There's three coppers there. Okay, so, you know, like if there's a bit of domestic violence happening in that community, they're going to ring the coppers from 30 kilometres away. They come there, you know, like, by that time, you know, that poor woman, she bashed right up, you know. There's nothing there. There's no library. Yeah, you know, in that place there, no high school, no internet, you know, for access for the children, and that sort of thing. These people have been ignored. This is basic infrastructure that I thought our people were entitled to as citizens of this country. But it would appear to me that we have a discounted form of citizenship in this country. We Aboriginal people. You know, may as well be walking down the street with targets on our f***ing backs and on our fronts, because, you know, that's how I feel. When I walk down the street, I feel like I'm a target, you know, for your hatred. You know, why do you hate us, you know? It's not our fault that you stole our land from us. It's not our fault that you killed our people and that sort of thing, eh? You know, we didn't do that. You know, and you want to turn your guilt onto us? Is. You know, you keep that to yourself. That's not my problem. You know, and you're ditching all these problems onto me and my people. You know, we've got young people there who are struggling to come to terms with modernity, with the changes in lifestyle and that's happening. Yeah, and then they've got this problem that they run into. Primary school's all right, but as soon as they hit high school, man, it's a different game. You know, it's a different game altogether. And these young people start struggling. We've got tremendous problems. Our children are under tremendous stress because of the hatred that you people are inflicting upon us. You know, have a look at yourselves. You know, you're supposed to be Christians, ain't you? You know, thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. You know, I don't blame any of you for doing any of that. You know, you didn't steal my land. You didn't kill my people. But, you know, you've lived off the benefits of those crimes. So that makes you a criminal. How many white people are there? They're not many, but yous are all criminals, okay? Because you're living off the proceeds of crime. In every state, that is a crime. Yeah? And how much time I got left?
I think it might be it,
mate. Okay. Bloody hell, I was just firing up. Oh no, yeah, Richie got to go. I got to go. You know, like I'm
high.
I think Richard is a good artist, and I think he's a performance artist in himself. He is the art.
You know, like, he was talking about clothes now, and how he had to have the best clothes when he was a kid. Well, so, like, one day I'll grow up, but, you know, now, you know, I try to dress better than everybody else. You know, so. Italian.
Do you want to sit over there, Richard? Richard, do you want to move over so I can sit there? Who are we doing? Vernon. Vernon? Yeah, next speaker's Vernon Arkey. Vernon's born in Innisfail. Went to school in Cairns. He's been living in Brisbane for over 12 years. He's, joins the long list of young Aboriginal people that decide to go to uni, get qualifications, secure careers in the Aboriginal arts area. And unlike Richard, Richard's had to do it tough. He's he struggled and he survived without the degree. But and Vernon's was lecturer QCA in Brisbane for was it 3 years or more? 5 years, yep. And I've got a long list of exhibitions and things that he's been involved with, but I won't read that. It's all in your book. In your pack. But I think Vernon's really talking about some of the things Richard's been talking about and challenging everybody to think about their role in representation of Aboriginal history and culture in an urban environment. So I'll pass it over to Vernon.
Hello, everybody. Didn't Richard Bell say that he was a recovering racist?
Yeah.
I just want to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people and related clans of this country. It's important as ever because it's all our land, and as an urban Aboriginal, to put it into context, while we acknowledge the land is because we do own it completely, and we suffer under an occupying presence in this country. And people always say, well, what will satisfy you? And I always say that I won't be satisfied until the fact that we own all the land and we should be reaping, you know, most of the benefits of this country financially and politically and economically. And until that is realised, then how can we be satisfied? You know, we should hold the highest positions in this country because it's our country. So that's all. But by way of introduction about me, I grew up in North Queensland, and I and this it's a common story. I didn't grow up speaking language or anything, because my grandmother and my grandfather were sent to Palm Island, and they didn't they met on Palm Island, and they didn't teach their children language to protect them, and that's a common experience with Aboriginal families, particularly urban ones. And so I'm just talking about a few things that I think define what it means to be this thing called urban. Even though you have to keep in mind that if most of the Aboriginal people, as is demonstrated by the 70% urban exhibition and title, if most of the Aboriginal population in this country are in fact urban, then that doesn't make us urban, that makes us Aboriginal. So what my experience is Aboriginal, and if most of the Aboriginal people live in an urban context, then the people who live in remote communities aren't as Aboriginal as we are. You know, white fellas and a lot of black fellas, actually most black fellas, have been tricked into thinking that they're, according to geography and the kind of art you make, there's an authenticity that is attached to where you live and how you talk and your level of education and your financial position that determines how Aboriginal you are. You know, and as we know, a lot of us black fellas, you know, we get asked, are you Aboriginal? And a lot of us say very, or completely, or all the time, you know. And it's a big thing. I always say the hardest thing to be in this country is Aboriginal, and the second hardest is to say you are all the time. So. But getting back to this whole 70% thing is, so if we are Aboriginal, then but we have white people, governments and government policy, and particularly the arts industry telling us that we're not, then that's the kind of thing that renders us Aboriginal. So we're talking about, or renders us invisible, sorry. So we're talking about Aboriginal people in an urban context. And there's a process, like a conditioning and an engineering that happens in this country all the time, and it's to render us voiceless, benign, invisible, dumb as in we don't speak, and it's to make us mostly ineffectual. To keep us as an underclass of people. We exist outside of the mainstream structure. You know, you have different levels in any society, and on the bottom of that rung in Australian society is poor white people. People of colour don't even make it onto that structure. And so then you have another structure that has all coloured people, and on the bottom of that is black fellas. You know, and we know this is true because any other people of colour who migrate to this country, to fit in, you have to denigrate blackfellas. And any blackfella who lives in an urban context in this country can tell you that's true. You know, I know you might find some fellas who don't think so, but that's been my experience. My experience has also been one of at different times, some pretty dire poverty. I grew up very poor, but I grew up, in the pockets of my uncles and aunties and cousins, and we were all very poor. I didn't realise that I was really poor until I started going to school. And I think in grade 7, there were a couple of kids, white kids, who had $5 for lunch one day, and I just blew my mind, and I still can't believe that. And then when I went to high school, there was one kid who had $20. He had $20 for lunch one day. And
we only got 15 today as it was.
That's because it's Canberra. not much money gets dished out to the blackfellas here. So, anyway, I grew up really poor, but everybody I knew, all my friends, and I mostly involved myself with blackfellas and my cousins and things, and we were all in the same boat, and that was the Aboriginal experience. So there are people. There's this whole movement now amongst academics and young professional blackfellas who have, kind of a middle-class upbringing and a middle-class existence. And they say that that's Aboriginal too, and it is. But the fact is, most Aboriginal people are poor. And their positions are dire. And so that's mostly what the Aboriginal experience is still, and will be for a long time. And so that is another indicator of urban Aboriginal culture. So if your whole experience is middle class, that doesn't make you not Aboriginal, but it certainly doesn't say that you can speak for people who have a more common experience of being Aboriginal, and that's growing up in that context with a whole lot of blackfellas and all poor. You know, all going hungry and things, like eating bread and milk for breakfast, like I did a few times. So that's another thing. Another thing about me is that I'm not a recovering racist. I'm extremely racist, a big one. Probably not as racist as the rest of Australia, but we are all very racist, and it's because if you are born into this structure that we call, you know, the social political structure that's called Australia, then you are racist, because this is the most racist culture in the world. Nobody treats their native people like this country. And that makes us all racist. While it happens, that makes all of us complicit. Black people and white people. It's just that there are a large portions of society that are powerless to do anything about it. But it's a racist culture that we live in. It's extreme, absolutely extreme. You know, there's an image that Australia promotes to the rest of the world of being an open country and friendly and, friendly to its natives. And then when you come here, you see that the opposite is true, and that there's a segregation in all levels of this society. And when you live in an urban context, you see it every day. We wake up in the morning, you walk out your front gate, and you are hit in the face with it. And when you go to sleep at night, it still happens. Yeah, so that's the urban context that we live in. But that, it doesn't make us urban Aboriginals, it makes us Aboriginal. That's the Aboriginal experience. You know, and I make art for a living. That's all I do now. And my art is about my life, and it's about the things that inform my life. And I don't say that I'm radical or necessarily political. My work is oppositional, but that's because it's my life. You know. So, but this is an artwork I just chose for today. And it says, the Aborigine, if he be well, he then we must make ill. And if ill the Aborigine we cannot make, he then we must make ill like. And those are the kind of sentiments that we experience every minute of the day. We're very aware of the fact that we feel perfectly normal. Like, I don't feel like a child molester or a woman basher. But if you go out into any Aboriginal community that's dry, that's what you are. Absolutely. You're completely that as a man. You're completely that. Otherwise, they wouldn't restrict you from drinking alcohol. Which for me, drinking alcohol makes me sing songs, but not dance anymore. But it doesn't make me molest children. But apparently when I'm on Aboriginal communities or with Aboriginal groups, that's what happens to me. That's what happens to Michael. That's what happens to Richard. That's what happens to Wesley. You know, if I was in a community for a couple of weeks and some of my mates wanted to come up and see me, I would have to tell them that we can't drink here because you'll turn into a child molester and a woman basher. You know, there's a strong risk you might go home and bash a woman. And that's what we've been made out to be. We've been made to seem ill when there's nothing wrong with us. You know, so it's all about how we can make these people see. And they do it by making reports on Aboriginal communities, and they're very selective about it. You know, there's nothing more wrong in Aboriginal communities than you'll find in any other community. And people always say, well, how would you fix it? And I just say, same as you would in non-Aboriginal communities. If people won't go to school, you give them better teachers. If there's apathy and boredom in that community, then you give them facilities. If there are no jobs, you provide opportunities for employment. But in Aboriginal communities, as we know, whenever there are sort of initiatives created that could make that build some kind of sustainable economic base, it gets shut down. The funding gets withdrawn, and that's happened over and over again. The very first reserves were sustainable. But when they competed with the non-Aboriginal interests, they got shut down. And this has been the story over and over again. Because it's all about money. If it wasn't all about money, then what you would give us more. So that's basically my story. I won't go on too long. I won't get angry either. But I am racist. But we all are. That's the point. I there are things about this society that I hate, and but that's mostly because there are things about me that the society hates completely, you know. I just think, you know, I just hate it back. That'll do for now. Questions later.
Yeah, I think there will be questions after everybody's finished talking, but I'm lucky I'm the chair, so I can get in and say a few things now. But picking up on some of the things that Richard and Vernon have said, talking with Richard about academic terms, old money, the non-Aboriginal people that did benefit from the land that their ancestors secured and whatever, I mean, that's... A lot of the politicians today, that's how they got into that position, because they come from that old money, and it was their ancestors that were right at the frontier 200 years ago. And I even looking at my own family, my mum's uncle, he came from North Stradbroke Island, married my grandmother's sister from Southport, which is now the Gold Coast. And in his traditional country, he asked to lease 10 acres of land so he could start an enterprise. He wanted to run horses on 10 acres of land on North Stradbroke Island around Emedy. And when the application went to the government, the government people said, well, we should reject his application because his mother lives on the mission, which I guess was a polite way of saying he's black. And so you imagine if he had a secured 10 acres of land a long time ago on North Stradbroke Island, he would have converted that to freehold, and he would have chopped it up and sold it bit by bit, and all his grandchildren and great-grandchildren would be very wealthy today. But even regardless of that, I look at, particularly with my work that I've done with photographic history, I've spent a lot of time, you know, dragging out photos and having old people talk to me about what's in those photos. And so many of the photos in my family are of people working, people are building houses, people are owning. Like my grandfather, he owned a bullock team in 1930, sold it and bought a truck in 1933, moved with my grandmother's family into Southport and was contracted by the council. And I just see these stories, and in some regards, yeah, my family was nowhere near as poor as other families, but looking at and hearing those stories, there's reasons why, and I think it doesn't make them less Aboriginal. It's just that they they were committed to stay in their own country, traditional country, and keep their children together. And they had to work harder than everybody just to achieve that.
I've written something which I was sitting at home the other night, and I know we've had a long time to prepare for this, but I'm kind of busy, and I just sort of... I saw something on the telly which really bothers me, and it always bothers me, and it's like, you know, these commercials, and they're like, we've got a very young country, you know, you've got to think about this as a young country, and I find that highly problematic. So what I've kind of discussed or got in this paper today is a little bit about myself, a little bit about the philosophical that, you know, the things that I'd like to see change, and as many commonalities as you'll have with Vern and Richard, I'm sure, and Nita and Wesley, in that the defining moment and the things that actually, you know, bring us together is our Aboriginality. I'd like to acknowledge my elders and acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, the traditional people of this country. My name is Bronwyn Bancroft, and I'm the last of seven children to Bill, who is Jarnbin Clan Bundjalung Nation, and Dot, who is Scottish and Polish. I grew up in a small country town, Tenterfield, with a population of 3,000 people. I left when I was 17 with my husband-to-be, Ned Menning, who also happened to be my teacher and mentor, or tormentor, as some people say. I've never returned to live there, and as I went to study here in Canberra in 1976 to do art, it was 500 miles away, it was a long way, and I missed my family a lot, but I was really happy to get out of that town. My experience of that upbringing was not to remember the fun times like swimming in the creek and playing with friends, but bad memories. A policeman pulled me over with a siren on my push bike when I was in year 12 and told me that he was going to get me. There were rumours around, and Aboriginal mates of mine had come and told me that this bloke was serious trouble. These events occurred regularly to young girls, but no one was appalled. My mother went to the police station and reported the incident. There was a culture of silence, and everyone in my family who still lived in town got booked for anything and nothing. This was 33 years ago. The travesty of these events is the fact that people are continually beleaguered by others who intentionally or otherwise make a point of using their lives to block growth. Any growth challenging people over issues of injustice has always been plagued by inconsistency in this country. My dad, Bill, was denied access to education because he was Aboriginal. It plagued him that he was not educated like white people. But he did end up being an engineer in World War II and managed the barges at Madang and Rabaul. And there were a lot of non-Aboriginal people who owed my father their lives. So he experienced that. I have two Aboriginal families, a first family and a second family, with sisters being the mothers, and they all went to World War I and World War II. Because of Dad's lack of education, he was a sleeper cutter. He became a sleeper cutter, and he worked out of town. And he made sure that, he just said to us, you either get educated or you get a trade or, you leave home with something. In my lifetime, I've seen a progression of Aboriginal graduates, doctors, nurses, things that you wouldn't have thought of 30, 35 years ago. We have the expansion and acceptance of Aboriginal artists. But have we seen the mental growth that will allow us to benefit? It is utopian in character, what I prescribe, but it could be a real world where we support each other as people to assist in survival. I've been reflecting about the issues that have been driving my family and friends, and the one singular issue that binds us is the inequality of our people in this country. The injustices that prevail disgust me and turn me into a warrior woman for equal rights. The idea that you are better than someone else also breeds mediocrity, because there is always someone smaller, bigger, crazier, and scarier. Superiority is a misnomer and is the tenet of racism. The existence of such a notion allows racism to reign supreme. You only have to think you're better than somebody else to get into that club. My dad used to say, you are what you are, and you can be nothing else, just that. And I never appreciated the simplicity of this statement till I got older. What we are facing now as nations, as Aboriginal nations existing within this nation, forced assimilation, denial of rights, a glean of newspaper headings, articles and editorials are demoralising and gut-wrenching, with titles such as Terrified Families Flee in Panic, Welfare Crusade Seen as a Land Grab, expert critical of plan for child abuse checks. Minister did not, this was a classic for me, Minister did not act on abuse, advisor Milton Okopoulos, Aboriginal Affairs Minister New South Wales, who's currently under 54 charges in the court system in Australia as a paedophile himself. He didn't act upon it. Hello. Dealing in hypocrisy, the act of doing violence whilst preaching against it. Human Rights Commission examines Commonwealth Indigenous packet for the Northern Territory. Of course they're going to find out it's racist. Of course they're going to find out it's a breach of human rights. We know this. What is it doing to our people? Divide and rule instituted in every colonial takeover throughout history has always worked, as an ego can be fed and someone will think they're better than somebody else. This breaks any chance for cohesion. You should not get sucked into this vortex. It is the moment you forget to remember who you are and why you are here. Social, spiritual and environmental relevance are the only things that we should be maintaining as cultural warriors. As an artist, it has been an interesting learning curve. From my first review in 1987 by a journalist or a critic here in Canberra called Sasha Grissom, who I'll quote. I was doing a group show. It was my only second show apart from my graduating show from Canberra School of Art in 1980, and had this show in 1987 with a bunch of mates. Bromond Bancroft's work involves a complex problem of the appropriation of Aboriginal motives to form fabric designs for fancy, rich, white man's garments. While the artist herself is part Aborigine, and there is a strong set design work and decorative charm in Spiral and Snake, in my mind the moral dilemma remains. In her other work, such as her anti-bicentenary screen print, her political stance is expressed bluntly and forcibly. Now, I don't really know a lot about Sasha, but that review's inspired me for about, 20 years to overcome his ignorance, his lack of education about me and my family, and I might just take the opportunity to read you my response. I wrote back to the Canberra Times, of course, not getting any response back. To the editor, I wish to comment on Sasha Grisham's review of the Aqueous Humour exhibition in which I was a participant. His comments on my Aboriginality can only be construed as racist. There is no such thing as a part Aboriginal person, any more than there is a part Australian. One's Aboriginality cannot be measured. It is not the colour of the skin that determines Aboriginality, but heritage. I am deeply offended that Sasha Grisham should challenge my heritage. He might like to travel to Lionsville, in northern New South Wales, to meet members of my family, whose blackness might satisfy his criteria. As far as the appropriation of Aboriginal motifs for my work is concerned, the implication that I've somehow stolen my designs is bordering on libelous. My work comes from my heart and soul. The inspiration comes from my Aboriginality. I have never used traditional motifs in my work, as I am well aware of their sacred nature. His assertion that my fabric designs are being used for fancy, rich, white man's garments is scurrilous. I am dedicated to helping and encouraging Aboriginal artists to express themselves and to creating work for young, urban Aboriginal people. I have participated in a number of Aboriginal fashion parades, given workshops, and I employ 4 Aboriginal women in my shop. If Mr. Grisham would dare to visit my shop, Designer Aboriginals in Roselle, and discuss my contribution to Aboriginal development with my co-workers and fellow artists, who are all Aboriginal, he might be less sanctimonious and a little more sensitive. So we just go. That was a fairly harsh thing. I was kind of young. I was like 20, and if I been as physical as my brothers were, I just would have gone out and dropped him, really. But you can't do that because it's abuse, isn't it, you know? I had three elder brothers, who really gave me a hard time, so that's probably why I'm reasonably staunch. So I'm really confused, you know, I'm appropriating my own art, you know, I'm appropriating my own imaging. I became involved in Bimali Aboriginal Artists Cooperative in 1986 as a founding member. This was really exciting. We were a good bunch of people and we learned a lot about each other and about running a gallery. But the one thing I loved about Bimali's conception was the feeling that you could do anything. It was an explosive growth moment for us and the wider community and mainstream communities. One thing I want to touch on with Vernon says, like every time anything's successful, they close it down. I've been involved with Bimali as a chairperson, treasurer, secretary and member for 20 years, and we've been fighting closure in all those 20 years. You know, the minute we start to get any run-up to getting reasonably successful, they take away major shows, or curators leave, or, you know, people get embroiled in a sort of individual moment where they become the leaders, they're the ones who originated, they're the ones who did it. At the end of the day, if we don't work together, and none of us as individuals have made any great things, we've only ever done it as groups. At the 20th year anniversary exhibition at Bimali last week, it was fantastic to see so many supporters there and to know how many Aboriginal people have developed their potential from being involved with this organisation. When I was being reviewed 20 years ago as a part Aborigine, we were putting art on walls. And I did a piece I didn't realise it was such an important piece, but I'd been given a really hard time and I went to the College of Fine Arts to do a lecture and I had like 45 people. It was rather a large, group to talk to. And there was one woman just sitting at the front and she was tapping her foot and I always find that really annoying. So I kept going, gave my talk, talked about my family, you know, exposed yourself, because when you get up and do these things, you're exposing yourself. And you don't have to at the end of the day. You don't have to do any of this. And this woman said, question time, the hand goes straight up like this. I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to ask a question. So I go, all right, get you over and done with first. And she goes, why the bloody hell did you say you were a bloody Aborigine? It'd only be because you get bloody money. And I just went, okay. And I'd been ill, so I was like, I need a glass of water. So I just sort of said to everyone, we really need to work with this woman, because it's very obvious that she's an extreme racist and we really need to work with her. So they all came down and took her aside, offered to give her books to read that they'd read. This is the other students. Wrote me an apology letter. And by the end of the 2 hours, she was never going to change, but at least I knew that the other 39 people in the group were really great people. So there is, you know, a sense of optimism. What I consider to be a highlight of this life are the joys and learning that have come from my art. I'm currently curating 3 or 4 small women artist shows and exhibiting, mentoring, workshopping and looking after immediate and extended family. I am a part and a part of something. I have my own relevance of this and as a consequence, knowing that I acknowledge that we need to start rewarding each other because we are a family and if I have a problem, sort it out face to face. A month ago, we opened an exhibition in Balmain for a lot of my extended family members. And when I spoke to open it, I said that one of the members, Kim Healy, only wanted a water pump from the art sales. She's living in the bush. A lot of people were humbled by that. And we don't know what people need until we ask them. We do not have enough time to subscribe to the framework of a foreign political structure. We should be building our own protective structures, only known to our families and communities, and in general, should not be letting the government repeal land rights, human rights abuse, native title to be, you know, resumed, a treaty, a protection of culture, compensation for past abuses. This should be paramount in our crusade as people. In summary, I can only hope that you are all registered to vote as a change in this country is needed for the recognition of Aboriginal people. Thank you.
Thanks, Bronwyn. I think with each speaker here, and I think each professional that's worked in this area, I think for us each sort of decade is a different sort of. We've had a different future, different outlook, especially when we started. And I know when I started studying in 1987, there wasn't a clear career path where I was going to go, but I knew I had to get a degree so that I could at least, that would hopefully secure me a dream of a career in the Aboriginal cultural heritage area. But then you have to give credit to people like Bronwyn, who were there back in 1976 starting. So, you know, it was just such an even more of an achievement, even more of a dream to say, yeah, we're going to survive in this industry and all these years later, and to be earning a living from art is an incredible achievement. Moving on, next speaker, sorry for the mix-up before, Anita Heiss. Anita was born in Sydney, lives in Sydney, and I think her work really embodies what documentation of urban Aboriginal culture is. I will read what she's got here, a short bio. As an author, poet, social commentator and cultural activist, Anita is the National Coordinator of Black Words, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Writers and Storytellers Database. She's the Deputy Chair of the Australian Society of Authors, and her most recent works are Not Meeting Mr. Right, I'm Not Racist, But, and Yira and Her Deadly Dog, Demon. So, Anita.
Hello, everybody. I am from the Wiradjuri Nation of Central New South Wales. My mob's from Cowra. I was born in Gadigal country. Most of you will know that as the city of Sydney. And I've spent most of my life living on Dharawal land out at La Perouse. Interestingly, I've just flown in. I pay my respects to the traditional owners of country, and I thank the organisers for having me here today. And every conversation we have, you know, we learn something. And I think Richard said that we haven't articulated well enough. That has started. That's okay. We haven't articulated well enough this issue, this urban identity issue, and I have to disagree, because I think that if you turn on in Sydney at least 93.7 FM Koori Radio every day, it's articulated with every broadcaster, every song that's played and every interview that's had and every piece of artwork. Well, 4AAA, sorry, they play country in Western. But every artist, every piece of artwork and everything we say today is really an articulation of being an Aboriginal person living in an urban setting. This all will make sense in a couple of minutes. I've just flown in from Brisbane, where interestingly I was at an Australian literature conference and academics were still having the discussion of whether or not we were post-colonial. Well, white Australians might be post-colonial, but obviously anyone who is aware of what's happening in remote communities in Australia right now, as we speak here this very minute, will know that black Australia is still being colonised. How does that link to today? Well, often it is the urban populations with access to a range of services and facilities denied to those in more remote areas. That means that we, as urbanites and suburbanites, or whatever we want to call ourselves, are afforded the access and the platforms and the power, because we sit here in complete positions of privilege today because we have a platform, we have the power to have the discussions around defining who we are, particularly in the 21st century. And it is this sense of enormous privilege that I have been given as an urban dweller, if that's what we want to say, that drives me to produce the material that I do. And Vernon made the point about, you know, while there are people living in certain economic levels of privilege compared to the bulk of Indigenous Australia, it's neither more or less black. And I say to my students when I travel across America, think of the top 1% of this nation. The top 1%, what sort of jobs do they have? What sort of power do they have? Where do they live? Who are they? And they say they're senators and they're mining magnates and oil people and whatever. I go, well, I'm the top 1% of the bottom 2.5%. So don't look at me and think Indigenous Australia's doing all right. I'm just in a position of privilege because I've had all the benefits that any child born anywhere, all the human rights that any child born anywhere should have had. And that's access to education and health and housing and two parents who are allowed to raise me without fear of removal. So but in an Indigenous context, I'm completely privileged. In the white context, I'm just normal. So I'm driven to produce material based on those sort of things. To demonstrate some examples of the urban voice today, I wanted to talk about two books released this year, which are both set in urban environs in Sydney, La Perouse, which is what you're seeing on the screen, and Coogee. And they're both about urban Aboriginal people. And while having two distinctly different audiences, one's for young readers, this is for young readers, and one's for adult female readers, both had the same goals in mind. To make the point that we are a diverse nation of peoples and that many of us live in urban centres, 70%, one fifth of the entire Indigenous population lives in something like in Greater Sydney. So most of us live in urban centres, and we live there for many reasons. Some of them are historical relocation, but many have also moved to urban centres for the purpose of education, for employment and for relationships. No jokes, Richard. The books were also about making the point that while the east coast of Australia may have been the hardest hit by the process of colonisation, I've written myself an extra note here, and that our sacred sites may be covered in tar and concrete, there still is ongoing history and heritage in our cities, and that the Koori kids at La Perouse, or middle-class educated bourgeois black women in Coogee, are no more or less Aboriginal than our countrymen or women in other parts of Australia. It is essentially our experiences as Aboriginal people that make us different to those living in other places. So in terms of the title of my paper, which was Concrete Couriers with Westfield Dreamings, I just wanted to point out that I was quoted by a journalist in the Melbourne Age a few years ago saying I'm a concrete courier with Westfield Dreaming. It was a throwaway line I made at the time as a joke, and it's been used by many reviewers and interviewers and reporters since, and a Spanish filmmaker read it online somewhere in preparation for an interview that they were doing with me, and then mid-interview asked me, so can you tell me some Westfield Dreaming stories? And because the funny... you can't... humour translated is really really difficult, so you lose that... she didn't get it was a joke. Well, because I don't know what Westfield is, obviously. But it inspired me to write a collection of short stories called Westfield Dreaming Stories, you know, focusing on the elders like Colonel Sanders and Ronald McDonald and David Jones and, the meeting place, which is the food court. And clearly it's just a send-up. So in terms of being a concrete courier, I have my most challenging and rewarding moments in the classroom and lecture theatres, not only here in Australia, but each year when I tour the USA. On most occasions, students and academics often enter the lecture theatres with preconceived notions of Aboriginal identity and what kind of person they expect to see in front of the class. Similar probably to what, you know, Bronwyn had experienced in her lecture. Most of my American audiences here, when I was teaching at Macquarie in the US, have seen Crocodile Dundee, which is, you know, 21 years old now, and that's still the film that they all have seen and watched. So, and they see David Goldpalil and his role in that film, and they have fairly clear visions of who they think we are. Indeed, when I travelled to my father's homeland in Austria in 1992, I was in his village of St Michael, where the notion of Aboriginal Australia was based on what people had seen on documentaries or on the tea towels they'd been sent from friends and relatives from Australia. Both forms, and maybe this is a bit harsh, but both forms I felt at the time cashing in on particular kinds of Aboriginal experiences, largely those experiences outside of metropolitan or urban areas. So the understanding of my audiences and people internationally of Aboriginal Australia was based on the blackfella living in the Western Desert, speaking language and carrying a spear and still living a nomadic form of existence. So many of my students are very disappointed when they see me take the microphone on. I had a woman in the USA at the end of the lecture say, "Look, I actually came here today to hear an Aborigine speak. I'm not quite sure why you were talking." So I said, "I was speaking for the last hour," but, you know, it's the same sort of thing. People are only ignorant if they haven't been told. It's once they've been told and had the opportunity to know different that they're only ignorant if they maintain those thoughts. So I have to explain, well, I don't wear ochre. I wear Revlon. I don't go walkabout. I drive a sports car for the sheer reason that it's much faster. I don't speak Creole or Pidgin or my language, which was flogged out of the Wiradjuri people, as was most nations. I speak the colonisers' language, and there's something ironic about being published by Cambridge recently, the I'm Not Racist But book, which is about colonisation and invasion and the ongoing struggle for survival in this country, being published in the colonisers' tongue to say that. I don't tell time by the sun. I tell time by Dolce & Gabbana. But I do hunt kangaroo 3 times a week, and I do so where most Aboriginal people get their food, at Coles or Woolworths. I make chilli con kanga, kangaroo curry, and I eat kangabangas. These are the facts and concepts that I take to many of my projects, including the fact that Aboriginal people generally do not exist on the national identity radar. My favourite example of this is when Is it all up there? Yeah. Is when I overheard a conversation between an American tourist and a Melbourne man. The tourist said, "I've just been in Australia and I met a fourth generation Australian." That's pretty good, isn't it? Now, I wasn't listening to the conversation really prior to that. And then, of course, I started to really listen. And the guy from Melbourne says, "Wow, fourth generation Australian. You just don't get any more Australian than that." And I looked to my colleague, also we're at you, and we're like, "Try 4,000th generation Australian." Like, we're not even on that identity radar. And partly because we're expected to have a physical experience. We're not on the identity radar. So we have Chinese Australian, Greek Australian, Italian Australian, Lebanese Australian and Australian. And by that, of course, I mean Anglo-Australian. But we're not even on that radar. So clearly our long history, tens of thousands of years of existence, doesn't count. We are invisible on that radar. And so with that in mind, I was further encouraged to develop and write with the students of La Perouse Public School, Yira and Her Deadly Dog Demon. I wanted the kids from LAPA on that radar by having other Australian students around the country, black and white, reading about them in their classrooms. The project was born out of the 2004 New South Wales Premier's Art Award, which I was very fortunate enough to win. The original plan was to do 5 children's picture books. He looks really interested, doesn't he? He's not interested. I love that photo. It was to do 5 children's picture books, but once we got started, the first draft story was about 6,000 words and the first book ended up being 8,000 words. And it's interesting because I went in the classroom expecting the kids to bring in lots of gorgeous, and there are beautiful hardcover illustrated children's books, and I expected the kids to bring these books in the classroom. So I said, "Bring in your favourite book," and everyone had to say what the book was about, why it was their favourite book, give it a score out of 10, and say who they think would like to read it. So they did a little mini review, and they were bringing everything in. And I said, every book they said they read, I would read. As my task to learn to write with them. And they brought everything in from, you know, Duncan Ball, Selby the Dog, and Emily Eyefinger to Jenny Baker's, I think, When the Sea Meets the Rainforest, to the complete encyclopedia of fishing, which I refused to read. But what I learnt was they had a whole all these Koori kids had a whole diverse reading range and pattern and interest as well. At the time, there was a decline in picture book publishing, so it was easier for me as a publishing option. I thought it would be okay to get this chapter book published. So working with the students, the only guidance I gave them in terms of the character and story was I went in, I said, "Okay, the character's name's Yira," and that was because I thought if I ever got married and had a baby girl, I wanted to call her Yira, a Wiradjuri word meaning son, and she's 10. And basically they broke off into groups. I gave them butcher's paper. One group worked out, based on their life experiences, what Yira liked to eat, what she liked to do on the weekends, who her friends were, who her family, the family tree was, which took about 3 weeks to do. Details about her personality, what she looked like and so on. Somebody came up with the idea that there would be a Siberian husky named Demon. We had to vote on the name. It was a very democratic process. It took a very long time. We had to vote on everything. You don't normally find Siberian huskies at La Perouse, so that was a challenge in itself getting that into the book. And I went away and wrote drafts based on their ideas, which were based on their lives. So the final storyline is that Yira is 10. She lives on the mission. She goes to LAPA Public School. She likes the beach, yogurt, iPod, Casey Chambers, her best friends Judy and Mary, a boy at school called Matt, and her Siberian husky, Demon. But Yira's mum's sick of vacuuming up fur balls. The neighbours are fed up with having their undies nicked from the clothesline, and her stepdad just wants his slippers back because the dog keeps burying everything. So if Yira doesn't find a dog trainer soon, she'll have to give her beloved Demon to a new family, one who likes dogs, who run and dig a lot. And we've recently launched the book, and I believe that it's a book that gives young readers a contemporary view of one aspect of urban Indigenous life in Sydney. We had 12 principals from schools around Sydney at the launch who brought students with them as well, and they were all delighted that they could now have some material relevant to populations in Sydney that they could use in the classroom as well. I hope that it goes into schools around Australia, and while it's shown that Koori kids in LAPA in 2007 are just like other Australian kids and that they have iPods and eat yogurt and cookies and things, but it also, I hope that it also puts La Perouse on the map for something other than the French landing there and Tom Cruise shooting scenes from Mission Impossible. As you'll see by the slideshow, we're already working on a second book, Yuri Goes on a Surfing Safari. We've been down to Bondi with Clarence Slocke, who's the Heritage and Sites Officer with the Royal Botanic Gardens, and with Adam Hill. And we've got some material to start drafting the next story. Now I'm going to escape from there, and I'm just going to talk really quickly about the next title, which is Not Meeting Mr. Right. The work is set in and around Coogee, in the eastern suburbs of Sydney, with some reference to Blacktown, where the main character, Alice, just happens to wake up one morning following a block release graduation at UTS and has too much karaoke at the Covent Garden afterwards. The main character is 28. I think I've meant to do that. She's a 28-year-old Koori woman named Alice. It's not autobiographical. Okay, well, her parents are Aboriginal and Austrian and she lives in the east, it's not autobiographical. The men that are mentioned in there who want to take me to court may, but I don't think they will, because one of them was just one that touched his penis all the time and the other one knocked himself out in a break and enter, so I don't think they're going to take me to court. The main character is a 28-year-old woman, Alice Aigner. She's of mixed heritage. She teaches history at the local Catholic girls' school. Actually, she runs the history department. She's sure she only got the job. The nuns gave her the job out of some sense of, you know, we can save you. Coogee is actually close to an Anglican school called St Catherine's, and they have scholarships for Aboriginal girls that come from all over Australia. There's girls there from Larpa and there's girls there from St Teresa up in the Northern Territory. So it was interesting. I was actually interviewed by an Indigenous broadcaster who said to me, you know, why did you have it set in a private school? So we've even conditioned ourselves to think that our kids only go to public schools or they don't go to school at all. And I said, well, we have kids in private schools. We should have teachers in private schools teaching our kids as well. Alice is happily single until her 10-year school reunion, and she finds that everyone at the table at the reunion is married and mortgaged and can only talk about wedding planners and bridal registries, birthing techniques, sore nipples, stretch marks and breaking waters. Alice isn't even sure how many waters there are to break. She's concerned if hers broke right then she'd be breaking gin. Alice drinks a lot. It's not autobiographical. Alice decides she's going to meet Mr. Right and she's going to get married by the time she's 30, so she's set herself 2 years and she can prove that she can be a married mother and still have a mind of her own. The story then follows Alice and her friends developing and implementing the strategy for meeting Mr. Right. Her friends are Peter, who's a Murray woman working in Indigenous education, Lisa, who's a white fellow who works for the Aboriginal Legal Service just to piss her parents off because her parents are really wealthy white solicitors who run their own firm, but they didn't walk the bridge in 2000, so Lisa hasn't spoken to them since. And Danny, who is Peter's only married friend and has kids, but she's studying media at uni and can still talk about what's happening in the news like Palm Island. Now, I wrote this book for many reasons. One of them was to challenge the notions of what it means to be Aboriginal in the 21st century, particularly about us living in urban environments. As blackfellas live along the coast, all the way from Laparoos right up into the harbour, every suburb I can mention, the name of blackfellas lives, Maroubra, Coogee, Clovelly, Bondi, Tamarama, Bronte, right up into the harbour. I wanted to make the point that as Indigenous people, we read, those of us who are fortunate enough, we have communities in the Northern Territory with 93% illiteracy rate. So for those of us who are fortunate enough to be able to be literate, we read commercial fiction, so then why shouldn't we write it? I read escape-type novels on the beach and I wanted to write one that other women could read as well. I had to purge myself of some disastrous dates as well. But I also wanted to show the similarities between us as women in terms of relationships with men. I think we live in a culture, we live in a world that emphasises difference so much. Indigenous women, like other women, also fall in love, we fall out of love, we have dates from hell, we are disappointed, we dream about Mr. Right or Miss Right or whatever your preference is and so on. We also live by the beach, we drink cosmopolitans, we exercise, we work in private schools, we talk politics, we drink gin and tonics. Alice drinks gin and tonics. We go on hens nights, although I don't know many black women that have hens nights, but we go on white women's hens nights. We get waxed. We have, sorry gentlemen, but we actually have periods as well. We want roses on Valentine's Day. We drink champagne. We take holidays. We have sex. Some people have sex. And that's not about being black or white. It's not about being remote or rural or urban. The point is we are women, and regardless of heritage or socioeconomics, there are some things that are universal to women, and that is our experiences of utter disappointment with the male species. No, I'm joking. We do have certain experiences with, you know, it's a joke. We do have certain experiences I'm doing damage control after you, brother, this morning, right? There are some, and I'm sure that there are some differences. I do believe it's harder for Indigenous women to meet Indigenous urban educated women to meet men, because we do live in a culture where there is this stereotype of Aboriginal Australia, that we are either in the desert on the rock with a spear, or we're in Redfern throwing things at cops. We certainly don't exist in Roselle or at Coogee, and we shouldn't be anywhere else than where people perceive us to be. Now, in the book, Alice has, and I mean, I've had men want to buy me a drink, want to take me for dinner, given them my business card, and then have seen something Aboriginal on there and literally have a physical reaction. Like my card said, Anita Heiss, leper. You know, so I've taken it back. So these are real things that have happened. So this is one experience that happened, and not in this setting, but it was in Bondi, in a pub in Bondi. Now, Alice has mantras every day. I am loved, I will be loved, I am thin. Oh, that's my mantra. But this day her mantra is, I will be kind and compassionate to all the white people I meet today. Richard, you should say that out loud. It's a 12-step program. Step number 12 is, my name's Richard, and I'm an RR. I will be kind and compassionate to all the white people I meet today. That's your job. This is what happens. Walking down the narrow hallway of the heritage-listed building, I tried to seem confident, even though I didn't know a soul. Oh, sorry, she's going to a history association meeting. I signed the visitor's book, got my name tag and looked around. The room was already full of white fellas, huddled in little groups, chatting and being very civilised. There were no brown faces in sight. I found the self-serve bar, poured a generous glass of wine and strolled around the edges of the room looking at old framed black and white images of Bondi Beach from times gone by. No wonder history was boring to Aussie kids if this was the best a local history association could do to present it. I kept walking slowly, hoping that someone might recognise me, but who would? I'd never attended any of these gigs before. What was the likelihood of anyone knowing me? I'd have to make conversation with a stranger. There was no other way. At least everyone here had one thing in common, a passion for history. I'll skip a bit, sorry. I attempted a sexy saunter, feigning interest in the black and white photos, and soon found myself next to two greying men in suits, laughing that deep belly laugh that old men do. I quietly mumbled my mantra. I'm daunting and desirable and determined. I will be kind and compassionate to white people. I'm daunting. I will be kind. Before I knew it, I was being introduced to suit number one, who described himself as a descendant of the first people of the area. I was fairly sure he didn't mean he was Gadigal. He would have just said so if that were the case. But I asked him anyway, giving him the benefit of the doubt. So you're Gadigal then? No, don't know that family. I'm a descendant of the Collinses. You know, the Collins family. That's Collins with three L's. There's a park named after us. I refrained from commenting about the family with the misspelt name and got straight to the important details. So you're a descendant of the first family who were given a land grant after the local Aboriginal clan, the Gadigal, were dispossessed of their land then. Both men laughed that belly laugh again as though I were a child who had said something cute but meaningless. They were starting to piss me off. I tried not to raise my voice but continued, seriously, this is a history association. Surely you recognise all history and not just that which serves the coloniser. Of course, you are right, Miss Aigner, Alice Aigner. I head up the history department at St Catherine's. They both seemed a little surprised but impressed. They still hadn't guessed I was Koori though, probably never even met one before, not knowingly anyway. Suit number one continued. We here at the Eastern Suburbs Local History Association recognise Australian history, Aboriginal history and prehistory as well. My blood started to boil. I could feel the colour move right up my neck. Was there steam coming out of my ears? The mantra about being nice to white people was gone. What Aboriginal history? Everything that happened post-invasion is Australian history. Aboriginal people didn't dispossess themselves. They didn't poison their own watering holes or place themselves on government-run reserves and church-run missions. The colonisers and settlers, the so-called Australians, did that. That's Australian history. And as for prehistory, what the hell does that mean? I knew what he meant. but I wanted to hear him say it. Well, history before the British settled Sydney Cove, of course. He was unashamedly adamant. You mean history before the British invaded Sydney Cove, don't you? Or is it regarded as prehistory because in your eyes nothing apparently happened here for tens of thousands of years before that? Why do you keep saying invasion? It was colonisation. Someone would have colonised Australia eventually, better the Brits than the frogs, don't you think? This was suit number two's intelligent contribution. Invasion was what happened in 1788 when the boats arrived, mate, and colonisation is a process that followed. You should really get up to date with the terminology, and for the record, at least if the French had colonised us, we'd have better food and fashion. I threw back the last of my wine, mentally blaming white people for making blackfellas have to drink. They drive us to it. They make us need to escape their narrow-minded, in denial, racist, imperialistic bullshit. As I made my way out the door, I spotted a lecturer I'd had at university. A staunch lefty unionist, Ruby Timberton, seemed to remember me too. We made eye contact, both shrugging our shoulders as if to say neither of us belonged. I was happy for her to stay, but I was already tired of being the thorn in everyone's side. Ruby's stomach might have been stronger and her skin must have been thicker than mine, or maybe the discussions would never be as personal for her because she was white. Thank you.
Thanks, Anita. I have to say, I think I agree with everything she had to say, particularly the very important... Oh, almost everything, a few things. But particularly the point of the fact that we work in the Aboriginal Arts and Cultural Heritage area, we do get platforms like this to talk, and we do get the opportunity to articulate what it's like to be urban Aboriginal people. So we do live very privileged lives for that reason. But something I do have to disagree with is her comment about Sydney having the best Aboriginal radio station in Australia. 4AAA, or 98.9, it's now known in Brisbane, that's the argument. People accuse them of playing white music, but they play country music, very proud of it, and their motto is that they're sneaking into the back doors of racist people's houses all over Australia and they're riding on the back of country music. And they said, you know, the best way to upset a racist is to, you know, if you can hopefully get their children to listen to the message and hopefully getting some Aboriginal points of view across, it says the best way to upset a racist is to get their children to like blackfellas. And also one last thing, I think there's a few closet country fans out there, you just don't know it yet. Now, next speaker is Wesley Enoch from Stradbroke Island. So Enoch's one of the well-known family names up our area. And as a playwright, he's got a long list of achievements here. I'll try and read a few of them. In 2002, STC remounted Seven Stages of Grieving, co-written with Deborah Marmon. In 2004, Wesley directed Riverland for the Windmill Performing Arts, which was presented at the Adelaide and Perth International Festivals. And for Legs on the Wall, he directed Eora Crossing, a spectacular free outdoor event for the Sydney Festival. He directed The Sapphires for Melbourne Theatre Company, and again for 2005 Sydney Festival. In 2005, Wesley directed Rainbow's End and Bitten Back for Coomba Jadara, and Black Media for Malthouse Theatre and Company B. And his latest play, Cookie's Table, won the 2006 Patrick White Playwrights Award. So, welcome, Wesley.
Thanks, Michael. All right. Cool. Oh, this is working even better.
Oh, it's much better.
It's much better. I can actually do a bit of freeform. Cool. Hey, I'm one of the people that disappointed Anita Heiss. You're right. Cool. I have this story about my father. I grew up in Woodridge, which is an outer suburb of Brisbane, but the family come from Stradbroke Island. Hi, Joy. Who's she?
Wrong one.
I actually don't have anything on this for me, so...
Oh, you don't?
No.
Well, that's a good thing.
But I'm sure Joy will tell us all about herself later. But my father had this story about, My father had this story about that he could light a fire in the pouring rain and cook a meal on it. And every Sunday, my father would send us out into, like, there's a spare allotment, quite large allotment behind the suburban houses, and we'd go and we'd pick up, you know, branches. Have this memory of dragging down half a tree down the road, and we'd break it up and we'd have this fire every Sunday night. The neighbours would actually sit outside, you know, or looking behind their screen doors, looking out at us in the back, having this kind of bonfire, basically. And then it started to rain, and my father went, oh, no, and the fire went out, and he said, oh. And we go, Dad, you can cook a meal on a fire in the pouring rain. Why don't you do it now for us? And he went, oh, yeah. Well, you kids get out of the rain. And he's out there for like 20 minutes trying to light this fire again, get this fire going. And no good, he just disappears for a second. We're looking out going, what's going on? The neighbours are looking out going, what's going on now? What's these crazy black fellas next door doing? And he walks out of the shed with a fucking can of petrol. And he goes, bring down the sausages! Like this. And there's something about this sense of storytelling, which has kind of informed my identity, what my father would say, how he would say. My grandfather's people come from Stradbroke Island, North Stradbroke, Minjidaba. Very early on, our family were on Myra Mission, the mission there. And, you know, you don't get a name like Wesley James Enoch by accident. You know, it kind of, Enoch is a good missionary name, good kind of Genesis 16. James after the apostle, Enoch was... Enoch Genesis 6, but Wesley obviously from the mission, the Uniting Church before then, the Methodist Church. So, you know, we have kind of good mission breed in us. And the whole idea that I see the act of creating missions as the first urbanizing influence. The idea of urbanizing Aboriginal people was to collect people together to either to modernize them, to provide them with services and to look after them, in some cases to soothe the dying pillow, but also, in a sense, to control, to look at how you could control language, you could control dance, you could rename, you could rebrand Aboriginal people through urbanisation. And I think the mission influence is part of that. So for me, storytelling is an important part of all of that, that you create stories and you create stories to identify and make meaning in the world as you are. That traditional practice has always been about defining who you are and defining the landscape in which you are in. The traditional storytelling through dance, through language, through song and art has been about trying to make meaning of the world. Now, as we become more and more contemporary, there is pressure upon us to become, to resemble what I'm going to call a museum idea of Aboriginal culture. We must look like a particular type of person. We must speak like a particular type of person. We have, in some respects, replaced the language of half-caste, quarter-caste, quadroon, etc., with the language of urban and, well, rural and remote. And often, I don't even hear that term often, rural and remote. What we hear is there are urban and there are traditional. Urban being a moniker that we wear because as a locator, where we are, but traditional somehow being this thing that is out there away from us, whoever us is. So we have replaced one language and a search for a definition of what is Aboriginality. My dad worked in a quarry. When Dad left school, he left education when he was 10 and started working at Conrutile, the mining company on Stradbroke Island. And, Dad's the eldest of 13. And my grandfather died when Dad was 17. So he had the other younger kids to look after when he was 17, to look after all these kids. My youngest uncle just got married last weekend in Cairns. And he's a massive family. I'm one of 42 first cousins on that side of the family. That's just first cousins, and then you start to go, boom, it's huge. But Dad can pick up a rock anywhere in Brisbane, and he can pretty much tell you where it comes from. He can go, oh, yeah, that must come from Redcliffe because it's this kind of volcanic rock that's blah, 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 blah. And his knowledge of land comes from, in fact, his ability to dissect it and pull it apart. He drives quarry rigs like loaders and works on, you know, smashing rocks down to smallest pieces, and he's got this amazing ability to understand landscape. He can dissect a hill like that, I'm told, Not that's something I'm quite proud of, but it provided him with an economic base. And he talked about the idea of economics in this urbanising process, that as Aboriginal people, we had an economic system which was based on subsistence, living on the land, creating an economic system which was maybe about bartering if you didn't have things, but about looking after yourself. Now, when colonisation happened, when invasion happened, and that system, that economic system was overturned, it was replaced with a welfare kind of controlling urbanisation, which the missions, etc. And then when we start to go, okay, let's kind of have a little bit more self-determination and we get off the kind of dogget, or we get onto the kind of idea that we can control our own communities. It's not individual ownership, it's collective ownership, and that the government still has to legislate for us and all those kind of things. And then that grows again and again. Now, all the way through this, Aboriginal people... here's a story that, you know, the whole idea of Aboriginal people working on cattle runs, droving, all of that stuff, and often was just, you know, tobacco and flour and sugar and tea, and everyone knows those kind of stories. And then in 1971, when you had to pay, it was legal, that you had to pay equal wage for equal day's work, no matter what cultural background you came from, suddenly all that employment was gone because you were paying white people for that. The stolen wages cases, which I know are raging across the country at the moment, where government would keep, if not the full wage, a good percentage of the wage, and Aboriginal people were not allowed to access those kind of things. We have never been allowed to actually generate an economic base for ourselves. I mean, the whole idea now that Noel Pearson is talking about individual ownership of land and homes and all that kind of stuff is an interesting one, because it's actually saying, can we build our own economic base that we can then at least pass on through you know, families, pass on and on and on and on. What are the pitfalls of that? Do you actually have a situation where, in fact, you have individual ownership of land, individual ownership of a house, but in fact, through whatever means, you lose that, and you end up being, again, renting off a non-Aboriginal person. So you have these Aboriginal communities owned by non-Aboriginal people that, you know, so you're again in the kind of the pocket of non-Aboriginal people. This kind of economic system is kind of always talked about, I think, because there's an idea of some kind of centralised decision-making process that all Aboriginal people can agree to. If you think about more than 250 different language groups and all the clan groups within that, one of the great failures of ATSIC, which is, I think, another urbanising force, about a central decision-making body for a huge, diverse, and I'm going to use the word anarchic to mean its original meaning, to mean small, self-defined, self-deciding clans across the country. To have a big central decision-making process, which is, again, democratic, meaning that you can somehow have a majority rule in an Aboriginal situation, an Aboriginal community situation, that this is the way forward, that democracy is, in fact, an Aboriginal thing that we should do. And I go, no, no. If you look at the kind of cultural analysis in terms of meaning, that the great urban push in Western societies for democratic structures is not actually an Aboriginal structure. We are inherently nepotistic. We are inherently about our family, our clan. We are inherently about elders, not necessarily about, you know, who can tick boxes and all this kind of stuff. So we fly in the face of a lot of Western philosophy in that way as well. And this is not new. This is not new discussion. This is kind of age old. But governments, especially federal governments, want to create one format, one response. And that obviously doesn't work. So here we have at the moment with John Howard talking about the idea of... What's that?
They want a single desk.
Absolutely. And when you go, like, you know, Richard and I, we disagree about things. Do we?
Of course.
Yeah, do we?
I disagree with everyone.
But, you know, where you go... A system which is actually anarchic is almost antithetical to how government works, is antithetical to the urbanising forces that I think, as the country grows and becomes bigger and bigger and bigger, how do we as Aboriginal people create an alternate government structure where we are really about our own clan, our own elder structure, and economically how we build together? I mean, you think back to the whole kind of Malcolm X economic strategies, which is how do we only look at our own... we go to Aboriginal shops and we create an economic cycle which is internal. How do we create that for ourselves? Which is, you know, interesting, because we actually have economic kind of issues.
Organized crime, like the white people.
Well, you'd be the head for it with those glasses on, I imagine. But this kind of sense that this urbanizing forces is antithetical to traditional, or is the opposite to traditional, is kind of a point for me too. Because that urbanization has become, well, it has come to mean Western. If you live in a city, you are influenced by Western, so you are not pure. You are not a pure Aborigine. You are not Aboriginal. You do not practice an Aboriginal culture because you are not like them, this museum image of what Aboriginal society should be. And that has created, in some respects, an identification for Aboriginal people of disadvantage as an identifier. You know, if you are poor, if you are uneducated, if you don't have a house, if you have you don't have a car, if you don't have shoes, if you drink lots of alcohol, what are these other kind of, you know, stereotypical things?
Don't speak good English.
Don't speak good English. You are violent in your family. That this is what Aboriginality means, because we can deal with disadvantage. We can't deal with ideas of culture, because culture, ideas of cultural currency and the ones that we're all talking about today through anecdotal information, actually means you have to go back to pre-1788, pre-1770, pre-1750. Let's even go back pre-Japanese, pre-the Macassans, pre-all the other kind of ongoing trading relationships and everything that Aboriginal people have had for centuries and millennia. You have to go back and say, well, there is a museum culture, a pure culture, which existed at some stage, and that's the identifier of what is Aboriginal. My point being that has never existed. There has never been a fixed moment in time where Aboriginal culture was static. It has always been in a constant growth mode, that we now, having access to education, having access to technologies, having access to other bits of information, we have the right to change, to adapt. We keep in our head a pre-1770 mentality, which is about survival. We will use skills, we will use our cultural currency to create a different world. We are empowered to make choices about what Aboriginal culture looks like in the future. We do not get judged, or we should not be judged, by people who want us and measure us against an image which is not true. It is a museum thing. It's a snapshot in time. It is not a defining thing. So, your mob. So the whole idea for me of trying to push beyond these sense of definition and look at the cultural currency. How do we continue our storytelling? How do we continue our sense of survival in what we do now? The other kind of big issue that's gone along with this economic thing for me is about the burden of proof. The idea that we must now prove ourselves as Aboriginal. How do we do that? Often we will talk about our disadvantage. Often we will talk about our language, where we come from, our cultural structures. We will talk about, we will identify to you as Aboriginal. And I have specifically not done that today. I have not said anything about acknowledging owners of the traditional lands. I have not talked about I've used Minjiriba, Baga. Anyway, but, you know, like, you go, what does it mean if you don't say those things? What does it mean in this kind of a panel if you don't say that? Does that make me less Aboriginal? How does it make me less Aboriginal? What are the kind of questions you must put in yourself, in your mind, about what defines an Aboriginality along the way? If I kind of tick all those boxes for you, am I Aboriginal? Or is it something that's innate and something I can continue to do in myself? So those ideas are the kind of economic stuff and the burden of proof. And when we see about the native title ideas at the moment, where Aboriginal people must prove an unbroken line, like, how do you do that? And through, you know, centuries, an unbroken line of connection with your land to even start to argue about native title, that you are belong to this place. So, you know, if you haven't hunted there for, you know, let's say 50 years, your family got moved off and you've got the stories, but you haven't been there. There's complications. We have relied more and more on anthropologists over the time, and I know we're in a museum at the moment, and there's kind of arguments about, you know, is is this the kind of the way of the future, that there is a burden of proof on Aboriginal people to tick boxes so that democratically the non-Aboriginal Australia can deem us Aboriginal enough. And I think that's a common thread in which we've all been saying, that the defining boxes that we're ticking are always defined for us by some kind of external feature, external body. Now, you can say that that's democratic. You can say that it's about non-Aboriginal people, you know, who have the purse strings at the moment. But there are some kind of ideas, I think, which are about our moral, the moral duty of this country to go back. I think we can reimagine our economic system if, as I kind of, I don't want to quote her at the moment, but Germaine Greer talked about in her article about 2 years ago about, you know, every person should wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and say, I'm Aboriginal. You go, oh, what does she really mean by that? And for me, it was a sense of saying, okay, so every decision I make is informed by Aboriginal cultural issues. We would have a different system of looking after old people. We'd have a different education system. We'd have a different environmental policy. We'd have a different way of working if we took that into account. It doesn't mean that Aboriginal people will not mine. It doesn't mean that Aboriginal people would not build cities. It doesn't mean any of that stuff. But it would be informed by a decision-making process, which is kind of cultural. I'm going to kind of just throw a couple more things at you. That this whole debate that's on at the moment about, you know, alcohol abuse, about sexual abuse of children, all those kind of things, I think it's something that we cannot hide from. And, as I grew up in a world where domestic violence was part of all of that stuff, and, you know, I think you'd be hard-pressed for any Aboriginal people in this room or beyond not to have known, if not personally or in their family, or know stories of all of that kind of stuff. And the thing that I think we have to battle against is when culture is used as a defence for these kind of issues, that we, as ourselves, pull up this snapshot in time, this pre-1770 or 17, whenever it was, 1788 time, we pull that up as a defence, saying, it's all right for me to have four wives because traditionally I'm allowed to. It's all right for me to beat my wife because if she disagrees with me or I'm allowed to beat her. It's all right for me to sexually abuse this young boy because, in fact, that was part of our initiation processes when I was growing, traditionally. How do we kind of do that? 1770, thank you. How do we actually make sure that we, as Aboriginal people, don't trade on this idea of the snapshot in time, the pre-1770s snapshot? How do we make sure we can say, no, it's a dynamic culture and men's business and women's business is useful, but up to a point, when do we actually have to, you know, roll up our sleeves and work hard at it? When do we not take the easy road out and say, oh, well, we can't deal with that because that's cultural information and we can't deal with that. But no, we have to, in fact, inform everyone of how we can debate these kind of issues and things as well. So for me, to encapsulate my big ideas I've just been throwing at you, is that the urbanising influences, I think, need to be acknowledged. Yes, they're there, but we need to analyse them and actually say, what will we take on? In the same way that we have to look at our traditional practices and ask the same question, what will we take on? What will we release and treat as part of our heritage and our history, but not something we want to practice anymore? You know, I don't necessarily want to be scarred. Though it could be a bit hot in a nightclub or something, showing off some scars. But anyway, what practices? That was meant to be a joke, but didn't work. What do we want to release and what do we want to hold on to? And that the choices are, in fact, Aboriginal choices. And that the pressures that are on us in terms of the urbanising pressures, again, some kind of democratic process, that, in fact, you know, majority rule somehow, that we should be allowed to release ourselves of those kind of things. We should be able to discuss issues and look at cultural analysis in that way. I've got one more story. In my house, just in the front of the house, there's an old stereo. And underneath that is, what would you call it, a suitcase, like a wooden box with a handle on it and stuff. And when people die in my family, their photos are all gathered up and put in this wooden box. And I kind of asked my dad, and dad didn't quite understand why we did that. And I kind of went, oh, well, I guess it must do something. And then I heard the idea that, you know, when people die traditionally, that you weren't allowed to speak their name, and that's also transferred into not being able to see their image to a certain time and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of went, oh, that's That's a process my family undertake, but we don't understand why anymore. That culture is something you live and breathe, that we don't often analyze it. And these opportunities to speak it, to analyze it, and to make choices are the way that I think Aboriginal issues in this country need to go forward with. So I look at that box and I see photos of my old aunties and uncles, my grandmother, cousins, people I don't even know, and people whose names are now lost to time. And you think, at least what they're teaching me is that the cultural currency that is in my family, the dances, the language, the kind of way that we bond together, is a continuation of practices that have gone on for years and years and years. We may not live on Minjidirar anymore, but we live in an urban setting, and we can continue our cultural practices along the way. Thank you.
Thanks, Wesley.
Theatre, it's all theatre. Oh, it's still on.
Turn the mic up for him.
Well, it's time for questions. So we've got two roving mics. And we'll, so if you could say your name before you ask a question.
Actually, I'm not going to ask a question, but I'm going to tell a story. Bernard, I take offence. I'm Claire Marlowe, Cultural Development Officer at Queanbeyan City Council. It's a position that I do like, but then I don't also like it. Bernard, first of all, I'd like to challenge you. All whites living here in Australia are not Christian.
What happens?
All whites living in Australia are not Christian.
Really?
Absolutely. Because what the Christians have done to our world is absolutely disgusting.
Yeah, they're worse than the Muslims.
Absolutely. Bernard, I come from a Jewish family, and one of the things I'd like to say about the Aboriginal people that, and if I'm being patronising, I'm terribly sorry, but I don't understand. You've all stood up there and said that you're from this family, from this family, from this region. I can't do that, because all my family were killed in 1938. So I'm speaking from the heart here. When we came to Australia in 1950, my mother was... there was a lot of racism. I can't say I'm not a racist, because it's been brought up to me, within me and my upbringing, to be racist. I spent 12 months at Papunya. I won't say that was a privilege. I won't say that was honour, because I was young, pregnant, and I was not allowed to talk to the Aboriginal people because I might catch something. Now, that instilled again, instilled into me the racist, the racist community that we live in. I have tried not to be racist. I have tried to be honest. I have tried to be caring. The projects I've worked with Aboriginal people, I have found that the people there have been very, very helpful. When I've asked questions, I haven't gone in to ask, do a report. I've tried to bring in programs to help. I have been patronising because I didn't understand. Now, from what you've actually said to me today and what we've heard today, has helped me a hell of a lot. I'm working with Aboriginal people in Queanbeyan with their artwork, and it's a fantastic experience because they are teaching me so much. I'd like to thank you very much for what you said today. Bernard, please, Bernard.
Richard.
You're getting the blame.
We're not all racist. We're not all racist to Aboriginal people. Please accept that and don't hate us all.
Thank you. Somebody else?
Can I raise this issue about racism then? And can I reframe it as prejudice? Because often I think that what we call racism is in fact an extension of a prejudice, that you create opinions and actions not based on personal experience but on what you imagine things to happen, the prejudgment of issues. And that happens on lots of different issues. I mean, Richard is a recovering homophobe as well.
There's people who don't like country music.
Yeah, country music. But there's a whole idea of, like, the prejudgment is often based on a lack of experience and a lack of exposure, and that often exposure and experiences will inform the decision-making and shift it away from prejudice into somewhere else.
Speak up, please. Excuse me, we'll have to...
Well, we've got a question here. We've got a question, haven't we?
Yeah.
I thought she was going on a discussion.
I thought we had a question, not a discussion.
Yeah.
Okay, well, next, sorry, Nathan. Next speaker? I mean, next question?
Is this thing on? Yeah, I do have a question, and it's been a question that I've had for a long, long time, and that is, and I'm glad we've got this kind of a panel, because what I've always tried to understand is, or try to get other people to understand is, how can we help the rest of Australia understand that there are Aboriginal people south of the Cairns to Broome line?
Yeah.
You know, when you put a line from Cairns to Broome, and some isolated desert communities, but everywhere else in Australia, there doesn't seem to be any Aboriginal people. Mm. So how do we educate Australia?
Can I just respond to that? It's linked to the sort of things that Wesley was talking about, definitions and language. And language is really, really powerful. And I think it's... And we're talking about collections and snapshots in time all meant to exist and look like a certain kind of Aboriginal person. And I think what it is we, as Aboriginal people in this country, we're not allowed to evolve as a community. There's a whole language that's created by Westerners that's used for us, including the terminology Aboriginal. There were just people here at the point of invasion. There were no Aborigines. There were people who identified by clan groups and language groups and skin groups and moieties, etc. And then a language created a group of Aborigines, and then that we were created by caste. And now there's a language that Westerners have where, as societies, they're allowed to become cosmopolitan when they have, you know, mixture and everything. But we're told we have cultural dilution and contamination. Westerners are allowed to evolve where our cultures are told they're eroded. Westerners have development where we're told that we're losing culture. Western societies become multicultural where we're told we're straddling two worlds and we have intermarriage. And Westerners... And it is linked to that. Mm. And it's about the language that creates the way in which people think. So, you know, and... When I travel, so we've got such a diverse group here, but what I would normally do is I'd say, can people raise your hand if you identify as Australian? When you travel abroad, you say you're Australian. Can we do that? Right? Great. Can you leave your hand up if your heritage includes something else? That's nearly everyone, right? So what you're saying is you have one identity, but many heritages. Well, so do we. But we're told, if I say I'm Aboriginal, my father was Austrian, oh, so you're part Aboriginal. You're half-caste Aboriginal. But it's not a language. I don't hear people say I'm half-caste Australian because I have a different heritage. So there's this language that's used which actually locates us then below that line that you're talking about. Because we're where the major populations are, where there's lots of multicultural... We live in multicultural societies in the major cities where there's lots of intermarriage and we're not allowed to evolve. We're meant to be that Aboriginal. But like Vernon raised a fantastic point today that there's more people... I can't do it as well as you did it articulately as well.
If most of us live in an urban context, then that must be the primary indicator of what Aboriginal is.
Right. Mm.
And if most of us don't speak language, then that must also be a primary indicator.
Mm.
But getting back to, I didn't get your name, but... But it's just talking about, and that Anita and Wesley both touched on this whole thing of the identity and living in culture, and that we're not allowed to evolve and things like that. But when you come here, you're talking about, you know, different societies mingling and different backgrounds mingling and becoming cosmopolitan. But it's all white. I mean, you come to this country as a white woman. You live here as a white woman. You can say you're Jewish and you can say you're not Christian, but this is a Christian country and you're still choosing to live here because it's comfortable for you. More comfortable than Indonesia or some other country that's dominated by black people. You know, people who come here come to this country because it's a white country. You stay here because it's a white country. That there's a critical decision that gets made to come here, and it's because it's a white country. It's no accident that when governments and societies in Africa that were previously controlled and dominated by white people, when they collapse, those white people come here. They don't go to Europe.
From South Africa.
They come here. Because this is the whitest culture you can get in the world, here.
Damn right.
And there's a critical decision that gets made. Black people come here because it's a white culture. They just come here thinking it's friendly. Now, you can't kid yourself. That's the most base indicator of what this culture is. John Howard says, we will decide who comes here. We will decide who stays. You know? You can't kid yourself about this country. And that's racism. If you make a decision as a white person to stay in this country, even though you don't want to be racist, that's racist. If you say that you're not racist and still stay here, that's a racist decision because of the way this country treats its black people.
You're too cruel, brother. That's like a stingray barbed through the heart, eh?
Did I say that? A stingray barbed through the heart. That's got to hurt.
My name's Jo, and I've got a question that's open to the whole panel. It's about the terms black and white, basically. I'm an academic, so I'm in the batch of people who aren't looked too kindly on, but I'm struggling with these terms when I write because there's a lot of Indigenous and non-Indigenous people who use the terms black and white, and I can see a lot of pluses, but I can also see a lot of negatives about it, and one of the negatives I see is that it's adding to that idea of what's an authentic Aboriginal person. When there are plenty of Aboriginal people who don't look black, and I'm a black Australian who's not an Indigenous Australian, and there's a lot of mixing of boundaries. So I was just wondering what you all thought about those two terms.
I'll say something.
Yeah, go on.
You know, I'm an artist. I'm confronted with a piece of white paper every day. I make a choice whether I use blue, pink, white. I'm really concerned about all the terminology shit, basically, because at the end of the day, Aboriginal people are Aboriginal people. We're not Indigenous. Like someone said to me the other day who was a, you know, five-generation non-Indigenous, non-Aboriginal person, said, I'm Indigenous to this country, so you people should be stopped saying that. You're Aboriginal. And you are being... You don't be Indigenous because I'm Indigenous. I'm five generations white and I'm Indigenous. All Indigenous is I'm born here. So for me, Aboriginal people, that's where it's at. We're just Aboriginal people. End story.
I'd go one step further, you know, to actually say, again, this is our whole idea to unify a huge range of people. We choose one title, you know, be it black, white, be it Aboriginal or Indigenous, be it non-Aboriginal, you know, all that kind of stuff. But if we were to go right back and go, okay, look, you know, I'm a Noonuckle Noogie, I'm a Murray, I'm a Koori, I'm a, you know, if we were to really talk about the diversity in our communities and stuff like that, and to go back to our clan names, which I think would be an amazing thing to do, to actually go, okay, there is no such thing called Aboriginal anymore. You actually have to identify where your family comes from, your land comes from. And then even in that, my family split off into three or four different kind of Aboriginal clans to have some kind of choice about where you want to identify. It would be so much more complex and so much more interesting. But I think, you know, black and white is a shorthand and it's useful.
And I think there's no answer either. There's no... Yeah. You cannot say that words are wrong or right. They're just in different contexts.
Nigger.
There never is an answer. You cannot,
who's going to pull that trigger?
I think it's wrong to tell people they can't use the word black or can't use the word white or can't use anything. It's just you have to accept language. You don't have to accept all language, but first you have to listen to it and try and sort out what's appropriate and what's not without. But you can't put rules.
I can see the problems of it in terms of... it really, when we say it, when I say black and white, it means us and them. But it means white is everybody, which is inclusive of people of colour who aren't Aboriginal. But I personally would like to see a move away from using the Aboriginal and Indigenous as terminology which was given to us and created groups and different groups of people. I agree with saying, I agree where it's possible, because tens of thousands of people who were removed can't do country. If for some people, who, you know, for the... But I don't know. Oh, I do know why we don't use the terminology of First Nations in this country, because that would actually acknowledge that everybody else came second and nobody celebrates coming second. They don't hold up banners saying... When they weren't at Cronulla holding up banners saying we were here second, All those racists with their placards were holding placards saying we were here first.
Yeah.
You know, so this is unusual. That, well, it's not unusual. I can see it's the language thing. It's very powerful. Mm. If everybody started using the terminology First Nations, I think we'd have a much better grounding in which to work from. I don't like using the term Aboriginal anymore because it's actually a Latin term for who we are. It's not our words for who we are, and that's why even just saying Koori or Murray or Noongar, whatever, is actually. But I can understand the difficulty for you, and it really is a segregationist sort of thing, because it really does mean. Yeah. Us and them.
Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know about you, but I reckon that the most common way that we identify ourselves is as blackfellas. Mm-hmm. Right? We all agree with that. Yeah. That's almost all over the country. Yeah. That would be the most widely used term and terminology to describe ourselves, blackfella and whitefella. Mm-hmm. So, and we shorten that to black and white.
But see, blackfella and whitefella, even for academics, I had a non-Indigenous academic say to me in Queensland last week, she said, you use the term blackfella, whitefella. I said, it's not negative, unless it's said with venom, you know, and then you know. But she said, how can I write that in an academic paper? I said, because I write it when I'm, you know, because the academy expects you to use certain terms.
What is academia anyway? What is academia? Like, what is it?
It's a group of people talking to each other.
Well, that's what we're doing.
It is.
Just to reflect on what you said, how you said that you didn't have any family, I just want to just say something to you. I've spent a long time working in and amongst my family. We really never understood why we were such an isolated family group. And we come from northern New South Wales. There was a guy called Edward Ogilvie who was given 138,000 hectares of our country, of which we were a part of, right? The Jarnban clan. They murdered every single one except my great-great-great-grandmother, Pemal, and Pundoon. There was a boy left. I never even got the chance to meet those people and have an extended family. And we've been fighting ever since then to reclaim spaces for each other as family members for just that, for the mere sense of survival. And when we do get together once a year, which we do as a family, we all come together, like, you know, hundreds of us on the riverbank, and we have a smoking ceremony and we wish each other the best. And we know we are survivors. Maybe we should just call ourselves the survivors, you know, because at the end of the day, we're not a television commercial. It's all real, it all hurt, and it's all pretty bad stuff. So I'd like, you know, people to accept the fact that whether you use terminology like Indigenous, Aboriginal, blackfella, whitefella, doesn't matter what your colour, as long as you're a good fella. That was the Wurrumpi band. And that was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I was quoting
We've been off songs
a great
now.
Band, but, you know, I did a painting called that, you know, and donated it to my son's school so that I didn't have to pay fees because I refused to pay fees. I'll give them paintings, but I won't pay fees because they didn't let my father be educated. So why am I going to give them any money? So you can make little... You can do little skirmishes. You can do little...
You're rougher than Richard.
I'm rough. But anyway, that's where I'm at. So I have compassion, I have all those things, but at the end of the day, there's a lot of personal stories intertwined in the weaving of this country, which, as Anita has, you know, profoundly said, you know, there's no such thing as First Nations, and it should be seen as that. Because when you go to Canada, they think seven generations ahead. That's their philosophy.
When I first came to Canberra for an academic conference, an Aboriginal academic got up, and there was, a large percentage of Aboriginal people at this conference, and one Aboriginal academic got up and really lectured every Aboriginal person in the theatre that we all should stop using the word Koori. I'm sorry, stop using the word Aboriginal and all these other different words, and we're all Kooris, and that's what we are. We're Kooris. No matter where we come from, Australia, we're all Kooris. And that one didn't go over well.
No.
We moved on from that one.
Who was it?
There must have been any Murrays in the room.
We want to know.
Actually, she was from Queensland.
You want to be a Koori.
Can I just also say...
She lived down here.
I just wanted to thank you for your story, but I wanted to say they're the sort of stories that you need to tell white fellas. I hear stories all the time, but thank you for sharing it today. But with my students, and I had 215 students a semester at Macquarie, All I wanted to arm them with was one line when they're at the barbecue or at the dinner party or in the uni bar and somebody says something in their gut they know is not right, that they could actually have a response. And I think the experiences... And I have people come up and tell me stories all the time about their positive work with Indigenous peoples, whether it's the arts or in health, whatever. And I thought, that your stories would be great to share when you're in those spaces with white fellas who haven't actually had those experiences. And when you hear somebody say something, oh, good, they're sending in the military, you know, you can say, well, you know, I was up in, sorry, were you in Papunya or something? Yeah. And you could say, well, and I think they're the stories that you need to tell each other. You know, they really help when they're confronted by someone who... Because quite often the racism that you hear in many places is completely emotive. It's not based on any rationality. Mm. It's not based on any statistics. I used to say to my students, make the statistics up. I said, because they won't have them. Because they don't. It's like all blacks get free cars. But they don't know. They don't have anything to back it up. You know, it's completely emotive. It's something they've heard on... It's in the Telegraph or somewhere, you know. Don't make them up.
Government makes them up all the time.
Yeah.
I love that, you know, when ATIC was shutting down all those Aboriginal organisations because of misappropriation of funds, there was this fantastic figure that came out, which was that the Department of Defence, that 10%, or I'm making that figure up a bit, that 10% of Aboriginal organisations couldn't account for monies. And...
They just did it the other day with land councils in North Queensland.
Yeah. And then what they did is they then looked at the Department of Defence and like 14% of all monies couldn't be accounted for.
Oh, yeah.
You know, then you kind of go, oh.
But that's a national budget. Come
indeed.
I was just going to make a point about how a number of us Aboriginal people view violence. I'll identify myself. My name is Alan Jungala Sambona. I'm actually a traditional landowner from Central Northern Territory. And... one of the things that we learned from our grandfathers and one of my blood uncles, who's a businessman, and I don't mean he wears a suit and carries a briefcase. And we were at the Elliot Pub one day when a couple of the new and old owners of the station came in. And after the stories that my uncles and my grandfathers told me of the abuse of being hobble-chained and belted with a bullock whip, and in my country, most of the men are pretty big guys. 6'2", 6'3", and those fellows have been pretty lean because they've been chasing horses most of their life. And so we said one day, we said to my old uncle, look, here come them fellas, let's go and sort it out, let's get some justice, some retribution. And immediately, my uncle turned to us as if we were fools and said, ah, poor bugger, he's old man, now we've got to look after him. And I learned a valuable lesson. I learned a valuable lesson that many of us young ones, and that I'm going back 30 years now, were quite bitter about the memories of the abuse. And yet here is the man who was abused, who was forgiven. And this was before reconciliation actually came up as a headline. And so for me, I've learnt over my last 30 years of existence that, you know, that kind of violence gets us nowhere. But at the same time, I must add that, you know, some wise person said somewhere that extreme situations... sometimes require extreme measures.
Yes. We should take up arms.
And I think maybe... but again, getting back to my belief, is that for us as Aboriginal people, or as a jingly man, the life of worth, or the worth of life was too much. So we just didn't take life. But maybe we should learn in the future to come pretty close to it. Now, that's being a little bit radical for me, because I don't believe in violence.
I'll go off, brother.
Or that extreme, but yeah... yeah, maybe we need to make a threat of some kind.
Hmm. I've got one more question here.
Can you just respond to that? Not that necessarily, but it made me think about the sense of, especially a lot of what our old uncle said, that we spend a lot of our time talking about the past because that's where we get our moral authority from. And that we do, let's say in Aboriginal theatre, a lot of it is about reading onto the public record our history, about trying to document our history and our beliefs and all that kind of stuff so we don't lose it. But at what point do we actually start to talk about the future that we want? What kind of future are we trying to build for ourselves? That we are fascinated by the past and trying to keep it all together. But I don't know, the challenge is to actually say, how do we build a world that we want? How do we look into the future and develop something that in seven generations will be the world that's what we want? We're still in a world where activism to change what we are now is often without goals. Activism to make change isn't about achieving anything. It's about making change.
It's because people can't agree with our position that where we are historically, socially and economically. We still can't reconcile ourselves with the kind of life we live that we should be living right now. You know, and I got a brother, and he asked me once, you can go off talking about, you know, identifying problems, but you don't come up with solutions. I said, well, you can't until people acknowledge that the problems exist. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's about where we live and our position in this society. I mean, and we're up here talking, and it sounds like this is good. It's a strong platform, and we're strong black fellas, but we're sitting in an institution, a building, which emphatically demonstrates how powerful white people are in this country. You know, this is one museum, and it details white history in this country, even to the point where it acknowledges that Aboriginal history existed, but gives it this small section of the building, and the building's bloody huge.
Blackie's Corner.
And blackfellas have this small section, and so not only is it detailing white history, but it's also very, very carefully segmenting the different kinds of non-white history and positioning it and telling us all how it fits in. We don't get to choose, you know. Whereas where I sit, if you're going to correct that imbalance, then as black people, as black fellas who existed, whose histories existed before anybody else in this country, we're the ones who should have the building, and we're the ones who should be segmenting everybody else and putting them in and showing how you fit into our history. That's how long it is. You know, but it should be like, you know, we've been here 80,000 years, so where the bloody hell are you? That's how the line should go. You know, that's how.
See, it's very different. Well, I think going back to these fellows here, it's addressing this is that we can't agree. You know, what are the problems? You know, like, we can't agree. You know, like on what are we fighting for? You ask 10 black fellows what we're fighting for. And you get 10 different answers, or maybe 11. I don't know. Yeah? So it's very difficult. Like, you can't have solutions to anything unless you imagine where it is you want to be. What is it that you want? You know, how can you have victory? How can you plan for anything if you don't know what it is that you want? And I think we need to sort that out. You know, what is it that we want? You know, is it sovereignty? You know, look, because without sovereignty, we cannot establish an economic base. This is the 21st century. This is Australia. Capitalism is king. You know, democracy is his queen. You know, like they rule. That's how the world is ruled. We have to have some sort of mechanism with which to go forward into the future. Now, we can't have that without sovereignty. You know, like sovereignty, we have to be able to own what's underneath our land as well as on top. Like I said before, you know, on all Aboriginal land that is owned in this country, the government still owns the trees. And so we can't even participate in carbon trading. You know, like all the white people, all you white people, you got, even in your backyard, you own that tree. We don't. So, you know, we need sovereignty. You know, we need, you know, like perhaps we can have something to say about the immigration policy as well, you know, like, and things like that. You know, we should be deciding what issues are really important to us. You know, instead of looking at band-aids, you know, let's start looking at what it is sovereignty means to us and what. Because we need that to get out of this hole.
But even in our own profession, as cultural heritage workers, you move too far ahead, there's somebody that's going to get jealous and try and pull you back down again and bully you out of an opportunity.
Well, I can remember Uncle Chick Dixon, you know, when Gary Foley and him were the chairperson and director of the Arts Board. And I went in there and Tracy Moffat went in there and Michael Riley went in there. And Chica Dixon, and it's always maintained this, that we should have at least 5% of the gross national product and should have had that for ever since the inception of economic basis in this country. Mm. And what that does is that that's a large amount of money, and that comes unhindered. That at least gives you some kind of economic base, but you do have to have a treaty. At the end of the day, without a treaty, we've got no bargaining power. We've got nothing at the table. We're marginalised. We're always marginalised.
Yeah. And everybody says, well, what are you going to do with the money? It's none of your business what we do with this money. Okay? So, who asked what the top 1% of Australia do with their money? Mm. You know, the top 1% of the millionaires, yeah? And what do you think they're doing? You think they're out working, digging ditches? Bullshit. No. Yeah, they're sitting around, you know, drinking, you know, wine, you know, sipping Chardonnay or some shit, you know? Yeah. But I don't care what they do. You know, and makes you can care what we do with our money.
I'm going to build biological weapons.
Oh, one question over here.
Why? What are they going to do locking up?
Listen, coming back, changing the subject a bit, coming back to identity again, I can appreciate Anita's point about, you know, my identity is Aboriginal, but I've heard young people, particularly those who come from us like more exotic half of their family, and they say, look, okay, Mum, sure, you're Aboriginal, but I've got an Italian mum, or an Italian dad.
She could have two mums.
I've got an Italian dad. I've been to Italy. I can talk Italian. Been to Mass, and I know my Italian family as well as I know my Aboriginal family. Why can't I be Aboriginal and Italian? And young people are saying that. I've heard them.
Well, they can be.
Okay, I know, but the point is, what do you say to them, though, as a parent? You say, well, look, if you go on like this, dear, there's not going to be any of us around in 100 years, or do you follow Wes's argument and say, no, well, the culture's got to change? Or do we encourage young people to say that? Or do we say you make up your own mind, or you talk about the family tradition, or what? What do you think, panel?
I think, partly it ignores the fact that Aboriginality is also a spiritual identity, and it's not something you sit down and sort of have a conversation about and think about every day. But, I mean, for me, I mean, I have a father who is Austrian. My parents, when I was born, the doctor didn't slap me on the arse and say, congratulations, Mr. and Mrs. Heiss, you have a bouncing baby Aborigine. You know, black fellas make babies. I had a bouncing baby girl. When I was 5, I got called every abo, boom, coon, chocolate drop and cocoa pot. White fellas told me who I was. Mm. So I was socialised as an Aboriginal person without even knowing at 5 what, you know, being Aboriginal meant. So I think there's a whole... And it's that thing, it is about a very personal experience, and I'm not a parent, but my parents didn't sit me down and say, right, this is what you are. You know, we just got on with life and everything. And when I went to school, white fellas made me black, really, and told me who I was and all that sort of thing. And I would go home and say, Mum, you know, why am I this? And, you know, she would, in the best way, she could explain what Aboriginality meant. But it's not something that I know. I'm not a parent. Maybe someone who's a parent can explain how they do that with children.
I'll give you an example.
Microphone.
I'm an Aboriginal man. I'm a jingling man. My wife is white, but she's Scottish, Irish and Jewish. And when you talk to the rabbi in the Gold Coast, he'll tell you that my sons are Aboriginal Jews. And say, that's a mixture of my family. And so my kids have been through the exact same experience where they've been forced because of their life experiences to make a choice very early in their life. What are you? Are you black or are you white? And when the kids have seen that for 3 months, my kids are very brown, they've had no choice. They've been little black chocolate pops. They've been the black so-and-so. The youngest son, well, he can pass for a Jewish person quite easily. Very fair, curly hair, but unfortunately looks very much like me. And so that makes him a little bit black as well. So the problem is, at very early in life, they get forced to make a decision, even though their genetic structure is one where they have a multitude of choices. I mean, I've had people come to me when I'm fishing down the wharf thinking that I'm Greek or Spanish or Maori. But in fact, none of them actually say, this is the adult version that you're actually Aboriginal. It's mainly the younger kids. As soon as you've got a bit of chocolate drop in you, you must be a black, you must be a Kumi. And so the point I'm raising here again is just confirming that the youngsters really don't get much of a choice. You either are or you're not.
It's interesting, this like search for a dominant narrative in your life, you know. And for me, I've got Danish, Spanish, Irish, German, Filipino, South Sea Islander, 3 different Aboriginal clans, Spanish on that side as well. I mean, you just go. You end up defining a dominant narrative for yourself, because to talk about that diversity every time you identify yourself is really interesting.
But I do think it's about socialisation. Maybe if I grew up in Austria and I had some sense of that, it would be completely different. But I didn't. I grew up on the fringes of La Perouse, you know. I'm busy. Like, I can get a beer and a bed for the night. That's about it. But, you know, I think it is about being socialised, and there's a lot of people who don't have that socialisation process, and therefore maybe they can make a choice. But
what I'm saying, the dominant narrative, is saying somehow we have to do that. We have to create a dominant narrative. We're not happy with the diversity within ourselves as well, perhaps. And that's kind of, you know, a maturation of this country will be where you can see, you know, the diversity of history, the diversity of narratives that's allowed to be even embodied in one family.
Oh, what you're talking about is where it was imposed upon you. Jack Davis called that the white man's curse, where they attach a particular type of Aboriginality to each of us. You know, like, and it's always of the violent drunk, you know, like that sort of woman bashing, child molesting.
Man bashing in
man bashing. Case. I was
going to You fellas need a flogging now.
I've just got one last question and then we'll have to line it up.
Okay. I suppose this is a kind of question. My name's Trish and I work here. My cousin is Vernon there. But Wesley, I guess I'm a little bit kind of interested in some of the things that you've said about the past and the present. And about, you know, when you were referring to the box of photographs and an Aboriginal man having four wives, and you know that's not right, and we have to leave the past behind to create a new future, and question these things, and all stand up and be willing to expose ourselves and talk about these things. Well, I guess I would say that our people have been doing that for. Ever since, you know, European settlement, our people have been fighting for a better future within the means that they've been able to do, being the oppressed people, and that we today, however we identify ourselves, whatever term we choose to use, we know who we are, we know where our families are, where we come from. And surely, you know, we don't let go of the past. The past is what makes us the people who we are today and what our experiences have been, and we hold on to that to create a stronger future and a strong future for our kids, knowing where we come from. So I'm a little bit kind of confused about your comments about dropping the past, create a better future, because I think, you know, the past is really what makes us, and when we were talking about, you know, Aboriginal people today, yes, we all come from really diverse backgrounds, and a lot of us now have privileged positions. A lot of us here today do have come from really poor backgrounds, and you know that is, probably not explaining myself really well, but you know. The reality is that most of us do come from really quite poor backgrounds, in our people my age, especially from our generation. And we were talking about, you know, defining Aboriginality, what's an Aboriginal person today. I'm not saying that people that have, you know, have been able to have better opportunities in the last 20 years aren't any less Aboriginal. I'm certainly not saying that. But there are a lot of us that have grown up with the circumstances that I have in really very poor backgrounds. My question really is about, you know, because you've touched on it quite a few times about the past and the present and dropping one to move to the other, and I would say that, you know, I strongly disagree with that.
I never actually said drop. My issue was actually about cultural analysis. To say, let's use the idea of a man having four wives. The idea is, my understanding of it, traditionally, if you could actually sustain, you know, if you could hunt enough and you could sustain a family of four wives and the children, yes, you could do it. You're allowed. You know, that was part of what it was. It was actually also taking on, you know, a dead brother's family and the whole kind of responsibilities that came with it. Now, the argument I'm putting forward is about cultural analysis, that often what we're all doing is just living and breathing it and under duress. And I absolutely agree that as a group of people in Australia, we as in Aboriginal, or in this case Murray people, we will go, okay, how do we cope? And we're in constant coping mode. We're not in a situation where we can get outside of it, look at it all and say, what do we want to take us into the future? It's not to say that we will deny our history or deny our past, but some things outlive their usefulness. You know what I mean? Some things, I think, you go, okay, this isn't actually useful into the future. Now, I don't know what they are off the top of my head, but we don't have a framework to analyse that at this point in time. I'm never saying about drop it, dropping our past, but we are so fixated on it, is my point. So, like, if this is the future and this is the past, are we constantly looking this
looking
way?
Backwards, yeah.
Are we looking this way and we're going to run, going to trip over every time something new comes up? Or do we go, this is my past, I refer to it, I keep looking where I come from to keep going forward so I don't get tripped up every time an obstacle is put in my place, in my way? That it's actually that kind of, I don't think our debate is mature enough yet. I don't think the cultural analysis and cultural debate. So we allow ATSIC to happen because even though it goes against every kind of social structure that we have, we allow it to happen. Why? Because we just trip over it because we're still looking back here. It's about the balance of that. And it doesn't mean that every single person is, number one, empowered to do it, number two, have the mental capacity to do it. You know? Sometimes you have to tap people on the shoulder and say, we need a leader. Go out and argue for us about certain things. And that sometimes we do have to go, this... I remember going to a conference once. I'm sorry to go anecdotal, but to go to a conference and it was talking about sexual abuse and a man got up and said, this is men's business and women's business and we should separate because we can't talk about this together. And you go, okay, I totally understand that. I totally understand where in dangerous situations, emotionally dangerous situations, you might need a very clear kind of format and a structure. Fine, I'm not saying about getting rid of that. But then some man gets up and says, you know, I'm allowed to do this to this young man because that's my cultural heritage. It's part of my initiation ceremony to get him to fellate me. Do we actually stand up and say, look, that may have been and that was our history, but now it's time to change? Or do we actually say, okay, that is your right, you're allowed to do that against this young boy's kind of consent. He's not consenting to do this. He's been told to do it by an older man. Now, that kind of cultural analysis and debate is not happening. And we allow then the Prime Minister to use it as a wedge and we go, well, if we control the debate, then we can keep looking forward and create a world that we want to. I'm not answering your question directly, but I guess I'm saying, look, we might argue that, in fact, cultural initiation and the idea of a young boy fellating an older man is something we want to maintain, but we haven't had that discussion. So let's have it.
Thanks. Wesley? Margo? I think we're finished, is it? Are you? Yep.
I want to thank you all very much. That was, I have to say, one of the best discussions I've seen between each other and interacting with the audience. It was a fabulous array of opinions, and best of all, of course, it was a whole range of diverse opinions, and no one had any compulsion to agree with anyone else, which is exactly how it should be, and that's the beginning of a very mature debate. This mob could just stay together to kind of move through the nation, we might get something done.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.